Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
Welcome back to Sound Effect from 88.5 KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week our theme is Better Late Than Never. You remember what it's like as a kid to be afraid of something? Those really deep down fears? Well, Dr. Kim Holland took swim lessons as a kid, but she still had this visceral fear of being underwater.
I remember sitting on the edge of the pool and asking Jesus to help me not be afraid in the water. Yeah. I remember loving the waves and being absolutely afraid. Not like a panicky, just, I don't know that I can swim. How will I get my air? How will I stay up?
She carried that fear inside her for decades, into her 50s. But the remarkable thing is that she didn't give up trying. She told her story to reporter Ashley Gross and described how things clicked once she found the right class. And not just clicked in a physical, knowing how to turn your head to take a breath kind of way, but in a much bigger, almost spiritual sense.
Kim Holland has just come out of the locker room at a pool in West Seattle on a Friday morning. It's a little crowded.
It's kind of hard because I don't like it when there's more than one person in a lap lane, because then you got to pay attention and not that the lanes are too narrow.
Nevertheless, she stakes out a lane and climbs in.
Oh, the water's nice and warm. This is amazing.
She would not have been anywhere near the deep end of this pool just 10 years ago. Back then, she was mystified by people who were comfortable in the water, people who didn't fear it like she did.
I knew they knew something that I didn't know. Yeah, and I didn't know how to get it.
If you hear Kim's background, it's hard to imagine her being afraid of anything. She was born in 1954 in New York into a family of civil rights activists.
My mother told me that my first marches were in Flushing, New York, when I was in my pram, in my carriage, when I was two.
By the time she was a teenager, Kim was an activist in her own right. She protested racial and economic injustice and was drawn to the Black Panther Party and their message of self-defense against police brutality. She joined. Their protest chants and rallying speeches by leaders such as Kathleen Cleaver resonated with her.
Black is beautiful!
Freedom!
That our water is free!
Everybody knows that all the people don't have liberties, all the people don't have freedom, and all the people don't have power, so that means none of us do!
These were people who, it seemed to me, were not willing to wait any longer for justice and for freedom. And they're willing to be in the vanguard and to step out and to risk their lives. And that's how I felt.
So here's a young, determined woman fighting for justice, taking part in protests, including one that turned violent. So you see, not a fearful person, but learning to swim, that remained out of reach.
I wanted to learn how to swim. I loved being in the water, but I panicked every time that the water was up above my head.
Kim's fear wasn't unique. Segregation and racism made it difficult for many generations of African Americans to learn to swim. A recent study says almost two-thirds of African American kids have little or no swimming ability. Kim remembers pools being too expensive.
My memories of New York were that you had to have money to go swimming. We didn't have very good means when we lived in New York. We lived in the projects. I had a cousin who went to the Y and learned how to swim. I did not have the availability of a swimming pool.
And she says her parents didn't know how to swim. That almost led to tragedy at the beach one day when her brother got too deep.
I remember all of us on the edge of the beach waiting, wondering what would happen, really watching my brother struggle. And finally a guy that was a white guy swam out and got him and brought him back because none of the adults that were with us knew how to swim well enough to go out and get him.
As Kim grew up and became a mother and a doctor, she wanted to break that cycle. She made sure her daughters learned to swim, and then she became a grandmother, and her grandsons really loved water parks, so she was inspired to try again. Her good friend Elizabeth encouraged her to take lessons, and she found out about something called miracle swimming.
Do you wish you could swim? Do you yearn to swim freely in pool, lake, and ocean? You can.
Melon Dash is the woman who created miracle swimming. Yes, she goes by the name Melon.
It's been my nickname since I was 11, from Mary Ellen, so I just go by it, even though people do a double take.
We're talking on the phone because when I reached her, she was in Hawaii, where she was teaching a snorkeling class. The aim of miracle swimming is to teach afraid adults how to swim. Melon was teaching swimming to a group of college students in New Hampshire decades ago when she realized the water terrified them.
It was clear that they hadn't been given the same steps I had, which were playing. It was playing in the water. It was spending every day of every summer from, 11 a.m. till 7 when the pool closed, playing in the pool with my friends.
So she started to develop a way to first get adults comfortable just being in the water. Melon came up with what she calls the five circles, a way to describe your mental and physical state. She uses pictures to illustrate. In the first circle, there's a stick figure completely inside the circle.
The first circle is centered and grounded, comfortable, calm, self-contained. That's the perfect place to learn.
Each subsequent picture shows the stick figure more and more outside of the circle, and the person feels worse and worse.
The fourth circle is terror, when we are really so afraid that we can't move anymore, and that's why we say in our everyday language that someone is paralyzed by fear or scared stiff.
Fifth circle is a terrible place to be. It's utter panic. So she makes sure her students are always mentally in the first circle, totally comfortable, as they get used to things like putting their heads under the water. Melon says learning how to swim is not about learning to do the crawl. It's about learning to float and stay safe.
And being able to be awake, alert, and enthusiastic in deep water with no qualms about being in deep water because you know you're not going down. You know the water holds you up, or you know how to stay at the surface and get air when you want it, and you know how to rest.
Kim Holland overcame her fear and learned so well that she now sometimes swims in Puget Sound. But not just that. The idea of staying in the first circle gave her a new way of looking at the world. She says staying calm and centered has helped her deal with trauma from her past, and also during this time of tense racial divisions that she says remind her of the 60s. As a way to help her patients and her community, once a week she helps lead something called Walk and Talk in Seattle's Columbia City neighborhood.
My goodness gracious me, are you here to walk with us? You are?
Yes.
Oh, my word.
She invites her patients and police officers to walk and talk together.
You guys already did your rounds. So
no,
you want to come with us?
No, we got one more to go. We were waiting for you.
Oh, sweet. Okay.
Kim says exercise is good medicine, and getting to know the police officers helps reduce tensions with law enforcement. One of her patients, an older woman named Pearl Beeman, is here for the walk. I ask her about swimming. She says she's never gotten very comfortable in the water.
I've tried, but I don't go swimming. I think if I'd practice, go back to practice what I used to know I could, but I don't. I feel like I'm too old now.
Kim tells her it's never too late to learn to swim.
There's no reason why you couldn't. And then you could float, and you could do that until you go home to glory. Do you know? Because even if a person can't walk, they can float.
Right.
Do you know?
Back at the West Seattle pool, Kim's ready to start swimming laps. It's not just exercise. She also uses swimming to practice mindfulness. She does what she calls a body scan, concentrating on one part of her body for each lap.
Up the toes, down the top of the foot, up the ankle, down the calf.
Then she sets off, gliding down the lane, deliberate and smooth. Kim describes being in the water as a total freedom, something meditative.
Sometimes I will do loving kindness. So one lap will be loving kindness to me, and another lap will be loving kindness to my loved ones, or to people I don't know. One lap will be loving kindness to Donald Trump. What used to be loving kindness for Osama bin Laden. As Christians, we're called to do good to those who harm us. It's challenging work, but it needs to be done.
It was challenging work to overcome her fear of water. But Kim says it started an odyssey for her. Staying in the first circle, she says, has allowed her to be more authentic and present. And she'd like to become a swim instructor to help everyone else feel that same way.
Now, I hate to tell you, Puerto Rico, but you've thrown our budget a little out of whack because we've spent a lot of money on Puerto Rico, and that's fine. We've saved a lot of lives.
When Hurricane Maria crashed into Puerto Rico, it dealt a powerful blow to the pharmaceutical industry. The island is an important exporter of drugs. Pharmaceuticals are a $15 billion business there, and that includes some medicines that are produced only in Puerto Rico, which raises the prospect of shortages here on the mainland. Reporter Katie Thomas wrote about this in the New York Times, and she joins us from Chicago. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Put the Puerto Rican pharmaceutical industry in some perspective. How does it rank as a drug producer?
Well, it's one of the top drug producers in the world. Drug companies and device manufacturers started building plants there decades ago thanks to tax breaks and plentiful available of skilled labor there.
You wrote this week that there are 80 pharmaceutical factories in Puerto Rico. Do we know how many of them are up and running at this stage?
We don't. And I should say that those are a mix of factories. They're pharmaceutical products. They're also medical device makers and medical supply manufacturers. And we don't have an exact tally, at least not one that's being released. But several of the companies have told me that they're either not back up and running or they're just barely starting to get into limited production.
What kinds of problems are those people experiencing in Puerto Rico? What have they told you about?
Well, there's been a host of problems. The biggest one is actually just getting employees to come in to work. These residents have lost their homes. They're still struggling with many of their basic needs. The second obstacle is electricity. You know, most of these plants are running on diesel generators. And while the companies say that they're pretty comfortable and with the fact that those are up and running and they're working, there's questions about how long they will last. If this is a long-term problem and then if it goes on for months, you know, will they run out of diesel fuel? Will the generators start breaking down? So that's also a big concern.
What are some of the drugs that are produced in Puerto Rico and, for that matter, only produced in Puerto Rico?
So the first thing I'll say is that companies generally don't give a list of which drugs and products they make in certain factories. And that's been a problem for people in the U.S. and around the world in hospitals who are tracking this and anticipating shortages and trying to plan for it. So we don't know who makes these products exclusively in Puerto Rico. But some of the biggest drugs that are manufactured there, although they could be manufactured elsewhere as well, include Humira, which is the world's top-selling drug, Xarelto, which is a blood thinner that prevents strokes. Even Tylenol is made in Puerto Rico.
As you've said, Puerto Rico is also a place where many medical devices are made. What are you hearing about that?
So the device industry is just as concerned as the pharmaceutical industry is. And I heard today that if conditions continue as they are and they don't measurably improve, they're worried that there are some products there that could eventually go into shortage as quickly as 3 to 7 weeks from now. One specific example that I was given was catheters for trauma surgery.
Well, if, say, production of Humira, which is a rheumatoid arthritis drug, if it were interrupted in Puerto Rico, are pharmaceutical companies equipped to shift production to another place? Do we know if they're that nimble?
So publicly, they say that they are. And in their statements to us, they've been putting the most positive spin possible on this. They are mindful of their investors, and this is a very delicate situation for them. But we know that the FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb has testified this week that he's very concerned about potential critical shortages. He said that there are 40 drugs that are made by 10 firms that they're closely watching. He didn't list which drugs those were specifically, but it's something that everyone is keeping a close eye on.
That's Katie Thomas, who covers the healthcare industry for the New York Times. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Canada. We should move to Canada.
We're going to get started today with a story out of Massey College, which you may know is affiliated with the University of Toronto. At Massey College, a senior fellow there by the name of David Morris last week made a comment to a black junior fellow, which has been reported in the news. They were at a high table meal. This is one of these kind of formal meals that takes place at Massey College. And he's a professor emeritus, David Morris. He was sitting with a group of junior fellows, including one who was black, and they were talking. And Hugh Siegel, who is the lead, the head of Massey College, walked in to join them at the table. Now, the head of Massey College, whether it's Hugh Siegel or anyone else, is formally referred to as the master of Massey College. The master. That's an issue that people who have been fellows at Massey College have been talking about for a long time because they object to that term. So just to give you that context, when Hugh Siegel, who is technically the master of Massey College, walked at this table, David Morris, the emeritus professor, turned to a black fellow at the table and said, "You know he's your master, eh? Do you feel the lash?" That's the quote. No one has denied, including David Morris, that he said this. Hugh Siegel, who is the, quote, master of Massey College, was immediately thrust into the media and asked to respond. Why did this happen? What are you doing about it? Here's some of what Hugh Siegel had to say about David Morris's racist comment.
To hear what he said was very surprising.
I think we're having issue with that. Okay, can we? You let me know when you've got that back. As we work on that, let me just introduce my two guests who are going to be talking to us for the next half hour, because we needed to get some folks from Massey College into the studio to help us understand this. And my two guests today are Dina Fergani, who is the resident junior fellow at Massey College, PhD student in Near and Middle Eastern Civilizations and Women's and Gender Studies, and the Studies of History of Decolonizations. Welcome.
Thank you.
And also I have with me Lahoma Thomas, who is a junior fellow at Massey College, a PhD candidate in the Department of Political Science. Hello.
Hello.
So we're just working on this clip, and I want to allow you guys also now to hear this. Here is how Hugh Siegel responded to David Morris asking a black fellow at the school if she felt the lash of the master.
To hear what he said was very surprising, only because it is completely out of character, and I don't think, I can't attribute what he had in mind other than I think he thought it was trying to be funny, and I think it just was a miscalculation. But whatever, what was said was said. I condemn it. I take it very seriously, and we have to address it in that way.
So there's Hugh Siegel saying that he believes that his colleague's comments were a miscalculation, a failed attempt at humor. Now, he said he was nevertheless condemning the statements, but no action so far that we know of has been taken against David Morris. So, Lahoma, I want to start off with you, and can you help us, or either of you who wants to answer this question, help us to know, first of all, what is Massey College? What is this institution within the University of Toronto?
So Massey College is basically an independent unit that is affiliated with the University of Toronto, and it consists of roughly three categories: senior fellows, junior fellows, and quadranglers. The junior fellows are postgraduate students from U of T. The senior fellows are mostly professors from U of T, but also other universities around Ontario.
Right. And so David Morris is a senior fellow, and he's one of the people who attends these high tables, as well as being, is he faculty inside of the school right now?
He is I believe that he's retired, but he used to be faculty at the history department at U of T.
Now, yes, if go ahead.
And just a point of clarification.
Yes.
This incident occurred during the lunch hour, so it wasn't during a high table.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I made that error. Thank you for the correction. So I think we also need to understand, and our listeners need to understand, as I mentioned earlier, that fellows at Massey College have been saying before this incident happened that this title of master for the head of the college is inappropriate. Can you give me some context, Lahoma, on that?
Yeah. So last year, a junior fellow, a very brave junior fellow, wrote an open letter to Massey College requesting that the designation of master be changed. And I will say the administration was responsive, and they indicated that they didn't think that the term was appropriate any longer, but that the process of changing it was lengthy and that they would begin that process.
And so a year later, that process continues.
Yeah, I think what this incident highlights is that clearly there were other avenues that could have been taken, right? So currently this term is temporarily suspended. I'm glad that we've done that, and I'm glad the administration is taking those steps. It would have been nicer if that was taken a year ago when it was first broached by the junior fellow.
Dina, there's been a lot said in the media about whether or not, as Hugh Siegel referred to, this was a joke, whether or not it was out of character for David Maras. I just want you to respond to people who are trying to say that this was not a clear act of racism.
So regardless of the context or whoever said it, there's no like space or time for these kinds of remarks. So this is not an indictment of any individual. It's an indictment of the remarks that were being made. And that being said, like, we need to stress that these sentences were uttered in our home, in the place where we live, in our own personal space. And Massey or someone is should be held responsible for this, because Massey is responsible for making all junior fellows feel safe in their living space.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Disturbing threats against black students at Howard University. Police say that they were made by this guy, John Rust, and he posted the threats from a restaurant in Alexandria. Our Tom Rousey is live now with the investigation that's going on right now. Tom, what do we know?
You know, Jonathan, when these threats were made, this campus was a very nervous place. Some classes were even canceled. Tonight, students were both surprised and pleased to hear, nearly 2 years later, there's finally somebody behind bars.
I was a freshman. It was my first year here.
Troy Henderson remembers how scary the online threats to kill Howard students were 2 years ago.
People left campus. I left campus. With everything going on, it was believable for sure. So we were definitely afraid.
U.S. District Court documents indicate the night of November 11, 2015, John Rust went to this Panera Bread off Route 1 in the Alexandria area. The FBI believes he used the Wi-Fi there to post the threats. Upset over racial incidents at the University of Missouri, Rust allegedly wrote, "Any N-words left at Howard University after 10 tomorrow will be the first to go." The threat goes on to say, "After all, it's not murder if they're black." John Edgar Rust is a registered sex offender who wasn't even supposed to use the internet. Well before the threats, he'd pled guilty to sexual battery and indecent liberties with a child in Loudoun County. Students at Howard say even 2 years later, Rust's arrest for the death threats is a relief.
And it sets a precedent that you can't just say things like that online and get away with it.
As we speak, Rust is in jail. He's got a federal court hearing scheduled for tomorrow. According to court documents, the FBI at his home in Alexandria also found a hard drive with information about how to make bombs and how to kill people. Reporting live tonight at Howard University, I'm Tom Rousey. ABC 7 News.
Black babies cost less.
But first, a woman 9 months pregnant says she can hardly believe what she heard yelled at her while she was on a walk with her children. That woman says she wasn't far from her Dearborn Heights home when she heard racial slurs being yelled at her.
It only got worse when the mother of two kept walking, Priya Mann reports from Dearborn Heights.
This pregnant mom and her two kids were walking in their neighborhood when they say a pickup truck driving by slowed down and a woman yelled racial expletives at them. The family says they kept walking and came upon the couple in question and say it appeared as though that woman was waiting for them. So this mom started recording.
Not before you get shot. Step on my grass. Step on my grass. Black up our block. Motherfuckers, you thieves. Y'all don't up this city. Get my out of here.
She proceeded to say, get away from here. Detroit is that way. N-word, B. And then she said, I'm going to shoot you.
Mykia Eberhardt says the tirade she recorded was unprovoked.
You see, I'm clearly pregnant and I have two kids with me. And you threatened to shoot me and my kids. Like, is that serious?
Her 12-year-old son and 13-year-old daughter witnessed the altercation.
I was scared at the moment, but I didn't know people still look at us like that.
It's her children's reaction that got Mykia emotional.
I noticed my son, he kept looking back.
When she said she was going to shoot us, I really was scared for my mom and her. Like, she had her purse. Like, she was pulling something out, and that really scared me.
Mykia is a nurse and moved to the neighborhood 3 years ago.
And I didn't work hard to get here for somebody to determine whether I can walk up the street or not. That's not going to happen.
We were unable to reach the homeowner in question. Mykia posted the video to Facebook and took it down hours later after a number of racially charged comments, but hopes this brings awareness to what could be happening in your backyard.
Everybody's not ignorant. Everybody's not thieves. Like, anything that goes for one can go for all. We are all the same. We're just different colors.
Reporting from Dearborn Heights, I'm Priya Mann, Local 4.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenders of my country. We are the masters of our enemy. We are the saviors of my life. So be it until there is no enemy, but peace. Amen.
The deadliest so far. The sounds of gunfire crackle through the night air, but few seem to realize its import. Some think it's firecrackers. Some, the thump, thump, thump of helicopter blades chopping through the air. Some even think it's sound effects to accentuate tones of a country western band. Then the music stops and people fall, their bodies awash in crimson. And slowly, as in a dream or a real-life horror show, comes the realization and screams rip through the air, grim accompaniment to the sound of automatic weapons fire. A new city joins the carnage that is uniquely American. In the space of 15 minutes, dozens are dead and over 500,000 wounded, a new record. A uniquely American one. It's Las Vegas, Nevada, America's deadliest mass shooting. Politicians and cops hurl curses at a corpse. A man once, yes, but now a number. For he is now the last victim of his own hand. Politicians have never seemed so helpless than at times like these. Politicians, the most powerful people and powerful systems, offer prayers for the dead and little else. Why are they so helpless? because they've sold their souls to the gun lobby. And because the killer killed himself, he is now beyond threats of prison or death sentences. They will bow their heads, pray, and even order flags flown low, and little else. For like the killings of children in 2012, or the slaughter of dancers at The Pulse, that nightclub in Orlando a year ago, they have nothing but prayers to offer. As we witness the deadliest mass shooting in American history, that is, until the next time. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
An act that he imagined would incite fear and recrimination, violence and suspicion. An act that he presumed would deepen divisions that trace back to our nation's original sin. Oh, but God works in mysterious ways.
I'm James Vallis, a black man who opened fire at a Sunday church service in Tennessee, left a note that referenced retaliation for a white supremacist shooting massacre at a black church in South Carolina. That, according to the Associated Press, investigators found the note in the car of 25-year-old Emmanuel Cadega Sampson, who opened fire at the Burnett Chapel Church of Christ in Antioch on Sunday, killing a woman and injuring seven others. He was taken into custody at the scene. Law enforcement officials told the AP on Friday that the note referenced retaliation for the attack on a black church in Charleston, South Carolina, in June of 2015. The shooting, which left nine people dead, was carried out by a white supremacist who said he hoped his massacre would ignite a race war. The specific text of Sampson's note was not immediately released, and the investigation is still ongoing. But the officials told the Associated Press that it could offer a glimpse into his mindset. Investigators have yet to comment about a possible motive, although the FBI has opened a civil rights investigation. The shooting happened at the end of a weekly church service when Sampson arrived in the church's parking lot and fatally shot a 39-year-old woman. He then entered the rear of the church and opened fire, injuring six before a churchgoer confronted him with a gun, and then a struggle ensued, during which the churchgoer was pistol-whipped and Sampson accidentally shot himself in the chest. For the very latest, stay with BNONews.com.
I need some money.
Yeah, everybody needs money.
I need some money.
The only two certainties in a Republican Congress are health care and taxes. After the failure to repeal the Affordable Care Act, the Republican Congress and President Trump are turning their attention to a tax overhaul.
This is our year to chart a new course, to provide tax relief to millions of middle-class families and those who want to be middle-class families.
That's Texas Republican Kevin Brady, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. But some early analysis suggests the GOP tax plan would mostly benefit the wealthy. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Under this plan, the wealthiest Americans and wealthiest corporations make out like bandits, while middle-class Americans are left holding the bag.
So who will benefit? Professor of Law Dorothy Brown from Emory University writes on how tax policy impacts minorities, and she joins us now. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
From what you've read, how would this outline proposal affect minorities in this country?
So when you look at who is benefiting, so for example, they're keeping the homeownership tax subsidy, mortgage interest deduction. That's going to benefit more whites than blacks and Latinos who don't own homes to the same extent. Mm-hmm. They're keeping retirement plans. Retirement plans from private employers tend to go to those who hold jobs at the higher incomes, which again tend to be disproportionately white. So we know that even with the minimal sketching that we see in the Trump tax plan, rich white Americans are going to benefit the most.
Let's talk about the deduction known as head of household. That's what single parents use. This tax plan doesn't mention them, so it's not really clear what the fate may be. But first explain what that is and why it's important for single parents in particular.
So there's a system for singles, there's a system for married, and there's a tax system if you're head of household. So you're a single parent. The rate structure for you is better than, for example, a single taxpayer. So that means a single mother or a single father is going to ultimately pay lower taxes. That isn't included in this plan. Maybe it gets added back in. Maybe it doesn't. But if it doesn't, then that's going to be detrimental to single parents.
And single parents are overwhelmingly minorities?
Yes, that's absolutely right. Will impact disproportionate percentage of people of color. You're a single parent, you're trying to make ends meet, and Uncle Sam wants to tax you more.
If you were asked to create a tax code that gave the middle class a break, what would it look like? What would you like to see?
I'd like to see a tax break targeted towards two earner households. Because right now, if you have two single earners who get married, they pay higher taxes. And it just so happens that black married couples are more likely to have two equal wage earners, and white married couples are more likely to have single wage earners, stay-at-home spouses. So as it works out, white married couples more likely to get a tax cut, black married couples more likely to pay higher taxes.
We've been speaking about the impact of this tax policy on people of color. What are you hearing among leaders and minority groups about what their impression is and what they're prepared to do about it?
You know, honestly, I haven't seen much about that. So I think it's really important that we're having this conversation because I happen to think it's the 21st century issue. You know, you shouldn't pay more taxes because of the color of your skin.
Professor of Law Dorothy Brown from Emory University, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. You see, it's broke,
nigga, race him. When Americans declare bankruptcy, they have a number of options for getting out from under their debt. One, Chapter 13, is designed to help them gain lasting relief from bankruptcy, but sometimes has the opposite result. This is especially true for black Americans living in the South who are less likely to avoid bankruptcy than whites. ProPublica reporter Paul Keel investigated the reasons for that in a recent piece called How the Bankruptcy System is Failing Black Americans. It's written with Hannah Freskis and co-published with The Atlantic and brings Paul Keel to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you.
What happens when you file for the other major option, Chapter 7?
Yeah, so Chapter 7 is by far the more popular form of bankruptcy outside the South. And it's pretty simple. You show up and you say, here's all the assets I have. Almost everyone who files under Chapter 7 has, you know, amount of assets that's below the legal threshold. So they get to keep their possessions, and their debts are wiped out within 2 or 3 months. It's pretty simple. You're in, you're out, and you have a fresh start.
But they seize your possessions?
Well, if you're above a certain amount. So 95% of cases are people who are below this legal threshold. So, you know, if someone declares and they have – you know, a lot of equity in their house. In some states, they might have to sell their house and that would be divvied up among their creditors.
Otherwise, the creditor just winds up losing?
Right. The debts are wiped out. So it really is a fresh start, and that makes it a really stark contrast to Chapter 13.
Now, why would a Memphis attorney, Brad George, who you talk about in this article, say that there are good reasons to file for Chapter 13?
Right. So this was when I went into this. First of all, we started with the puzzle of Memphis has by far the highest bankruptcy filing rate in the country. Like, it's not even close.
Is it based on Tennessee law?
Well, I would argue not. It has a lot to do with just the way bankruptcy is practiced there, and also just the amount of pressure that are on people who live there in terms of collection laws and, like we talk about in the piece, people are just filing bankruptcy just to keep their lights on. So it's a situation that's pretty desperate for people there. But as we lay out in the piece, a lot of it has to do with how people are paying their attorneys. So when you declare for bankruptcy, the biggest expense that people are going to be faced with is paying an attorney. Attorney's not free. And typically, if you're looking at doing a Chapter 7, you're going to need to pay your attorney up front. and a fee is going to be anywhere in the range of $1,000 to $1,500. Whereas in the South, the way the Chapter 13 has been practiced for a very long time is it's Chapter 13 is a payment plan. So you're usually it's 5 years of payments. And so as we describe it, it's kind of debt relief on credit in the sense that you can file for bankruptcy without paying anything, $0 down to your attorney, and then those attorney fees are spaced out over the 5 years. The fee ends up being larger, but it's more affordable for people to get into because it doesn't require some, you know, lump sum of cash to start.
And you also don't lose any of your possessions.
Right. So it is the way bankruptcy is practiced outside the South. So 13 is something that is used very selectively. It's used by people who are faced with foreclosure. And it's good for that because if you're behind in your mortgage, you can stretch out your arrearages, which you're behind on, for 5 years, stay in your home, and then your debt is wiped out. That's like credit cards, medical bills, those types of debts are wiped out at the end. And so then you're back in your home, you're current on your mortgage, and you're back on your feet. And when it's used that way, I think there's pretty good evidence that it's useful. But in the South, it's mainly a tool used for people who are a lower income.
So in New York, we're less likely to see Chapter 13 applied.
Chapter 13 is very rare here.
Now, Chapter 11 is the one that the president has declared. That's a totally different kind of bankruptcy.
Right. So that's a business that's in financial trouble. And I think it's, you know, I think all the airlines have been through it at this point. And so you're liquidating assets and creditors get in line. The lawyers have no problem getting paid because you're often talking about businesses that are selling off their pieces. But I mean, I think one interesting thing is that's a form of bankruptcy that has, I mean, the president was very sort of straightforward about saying, I used the laws that were available to me. And, you know, certain situations, there seems to be different attitudes towards, you know, businesses that go into bankruptcy as opposed to individuals.
Now, why is the South the only region in the country where Chapter 13 claims are filed most often? Is it because lawyers are pushing for it? Does it matter whether those lawyers are white or black?
Well, okay. So to take that one step at a time, I mean, so Chapter 13 was born in the South. It comes out of Birmingham in the 1930s. It was really – so there's two sides of Chapter 13. Part of it is this idea that it's a more moral form of bankruptcy. And the reason for that argument is that people at least end up paying a portion of their debts through this payment plan out of their wages. Whereas in Chapter 7, you know, all your debts are wiped out. And so there's the idea that it's just a more honorable form of bankruptcy. And it started being practiced there in the 1930s and it took hold. And there's been this awareness that there's this regional divide in the country where Chapter 13 is popular in the South and not elsewhere in the country. And all these explanations about it's just sort of local culture, it's just sort of in the water there. I even heard some scholars wondering about, maybe there's more of this in black communities because there's more church going in those communities and therefore there's more of this idea of it's more honorable to do Chapter 13. It's more of a moral thing, and that's why people are doing it. I didn't find any of those explanations very convincing. And I think when you get right down to it, Chapter 13, and the way it's priced by attorneys in the South, is it's zero down. It's something where someone has, you know, virtually no cash in their pocket. It might be on paper they're better suited for Chapter 7, but when you get right down to it, you don't have $1,000 to pay an attorney. You're going to end up in Chapter 13.
The assumption, of course, is that you will keep a job and be able to keep on paying on the equivalent of a payment plan for buying a sofa.
Right. And that's sort of the background, I think, these racial gaps is that, I mean, there's, you know, as we lay out in the piece, there's an enormous wealth gap along racial lines in the country. There's a lot of research to show that, you know, in black communities, there's more instability among income. So not only are you making less, but your income jumps around a lot. You know, your hours are cut of work, that sort of thing. It makes people more vulnerable to financial shocks and makes, you know, a five-year plan kind of a harder gauntlet to run than it might be for people who are a little more stable.
What does it mean to have your case dismissed under Chapter 13?
It means you're kind of right back out on your own. So all the protections that were there while you were in bankruptcy. Those are gone. And as we say in the piece, you know, the debts that you weren't paying while you were in bankruptcy come back. So people can end up finding themselves in a deeper hole after being in bankruptcy, and then half oftentimes feel like there's no choice but to go in again.
And you found that in 2015, for example, over 9,000 cases in the Memphis district were dismissed.
Right. So this is enormous churn of.
Well, what does that mean for the 9,000 people?
That means they're right back where they started.
Are they paying interest rates, interest on the money that they owe their lawyers?
No. So the attorneys only get paid for how long people are in the plans, which is kind of an interesting factor in this and that. I mean, so on paper, the attorney's fees for the period that we were starting was $3,000. But the attorneys weren't getting an average of $3,000 per case. They're getting something like $1,300 because their clients are failing out of the plan so much. But because there's such an enormous volume of cases filed there, it was something that's a viable business for the bankruptcy attorneys down there.
So it's really a volume situation?
Right.
Because it doesn't sound to me like it's in the attorney's best interest to do a Chapter 13.
I mean, attorneys down there. So I talked to a lot of attorneys down there, and you know, often they would say, you know, I'd much prefer that they give me $1,000 up front. But the typical debtor down there is, you know, the average debtor, I think, was earning around $23,000 a year. These are people who are living paycheck to paycheck who just don't have the ability to come up with a lump sum. So there was some honesty from attorneys there in terms of why people are ending up in these plans. But there's also a lot of rationalization in terms of why, you know, this is not a problem. So that's one thing I hope comes out of this is sort of more reflection on how things could be reformed to make the system actually get people out of debt, which I think most people expect bankruptcy to do.
Do people talk about the racial divide?
They're aware of it. I mean, I describe in the piece, you go to the courtroom, there's no mistaking the fact that you have, you know, a pool of mostly black debtors, and then you have these attorneys and other, you know, court staff milling around who are mostly white. It's very stark. It's right in your face. I spoke to a judge there who was aware of it. But again, there's kind of this rationalization or, you know, an idea that nothing could be done about it, when I think that there could be changes made.
And the reasons the lawyers gave you for the fact that they don't see it as a problem?
It's that, well, someone comes into my office and they have a subprime car loan and their car is going to be repossessed. And so Chapter 13 is a really good fit for that because they can keep their car as long as they stay in the Chapter 13. Or, I mean, there are legitimate situations there. Like I said, people are faced with having their electricity shut off. There are things happening outside bankruptcy there that have racial gaps. For instance, the state is aggressive, and if someone doesn't pay a traffic ticket, suspending someone's driver's license. So people are getting in the Chapter 13 to get their driver's license back. So there's all sorts of basic needs that people are going to Chapter 13 to address, which that's something is maybe something more particular to Memphis, although I found something similar in Chicago.
So this isn't just the South.
No, this is not just the South.
Laws vary from place to place, and you could see draconian laws in all sorts of areas.
Right. No, things are hard out there for people in a lot of different places. It's just a matter of whether bankruptcy is going to be seen as a solution for that. And I think part of the point is you have to be honest about how good bankruptcy is as addressing certain situations.
My guest is Paul Keel. His article, How the Bankruptcy System is Failing Black Americans, is from ProPublica and co-published with The Atlantic. A judge told you that a dismissal doesn't necessarily mean something bad happened.
Right. This is part of what I would describe as rationalization is, you know, there might be a situation where someone is facing foreclosure and they get into Chapter 13 and they decide to get out of 13 because maybe they work something out with their bank. So there are possible situations. But as we point out in the piece, something like 70-75% of the people who are using 13 in Memphis don't own a home. So that's not generally what's happening. And as we show, the more money, more income that you have, the better chance you have to getting to the end of the Chapter 13 and getting debt relief. So it's something that's, you know, there clear inequities in the system along income lines, along racial lines that I think, have to be faced.
Now, you found that some of the lawyers were more idealistic than others.
Well, idealistic, I
focused, more sympathetic to their clients.
Right. I mean, no one was – well, there was one attorney in particular who had sort of a paternalistic approach where that he – that's sort of, I think, an old school Southern approach where he had this idea that Chapter 13, because it's a payment plan, teaches his clients how to, you know, live within their means. And so that's why he preferred Chapter 13, because it was instructing his clients. And then, you know, pointed out, well, most of your clients are not actually getting to the end and actually getting debt relief. And he's like, well, you know, things happen. But for him, Chapter 7 was like this kind of like nuclear, like red button, only if you have like $100,000 in medical debt. Like literally an example he gave me. Would you use Chapter 7? I mean, because if you use Chapter 7, you can't go back in for 8 years. But yeah, so that was one approach. The other, what I heard from other attorneys was more this idea that people want to hold on to something and therefore they're ending up in Chapter 13. So by contrast, I focused on an attorney who is one of the few black attorneys in Memphis who was doing a lot of Chapter 7s for clients. And so on a sort of
simple, he encourages them to do Chapter 7s?
Well, and I mean, just on in the numbers I could look in, he's the one doing the most Chapter 7s for black clients in Memphis, and he's not one of the biggest attorneys. Because the typical law firm there is doing 90% Chapter 13s, and he was doing mostly Chapter 7s. And so I wanted to find out what's going on there. And I mean, a couple things. One is he was pricing his services different. He was making it more affordable for people to get into Chapter 7. But also he had kind of a different philosophy in that he had what he called a come-to-Jesus meeting with his clients, which was, do you really need, you know, is holding onto this car really the best thing for you if the loan is not affordable, if this car has been overpriced? You know, is it the best thing to stay in this home if, you know, you're underwater on your mortgage and you can't afford it? So that sort of discussion he thought was meaningful. And then he added, you know, because he's black and his clients are black, maybe they trust him more. They'll accept his advice more since he looks like them.
We have a call from Patrick from Manhattan who's curious about an aspect of this. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
My question is this. I know that the student loan debt is crushing for many Americans, and also, student loans are not dischargeable in bankruptcy. Unfortunately, they're also not subject to most statutes of limitations, so anybody who holds that debt can go after you for a long time. These are federally guaranteed student loans. I know that. Did you find that the student loan debt figured in the calculation of whether or not to file bankruptcy was more pronounced in one group than another? For example, did it weigh heavily on African Americans as opposed to some other group, or was it just across the board part of the mix?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, I mean, student loan debt was definitely often kind of one of the factors that was floating around. But as you correctly point out, in almost all cases, you're not going to be able to get rid of student loan debt through bankruptcy. So the one case we focused on in the story was a woman who was in an apartment. She's a single mother of three. She's earning like $9 an hour. Navasha Miller is her
now
name.
She's in an area called Whitehaven. Is that close to Memphis?
Yeah, it's part of Memphis. It's where Graceland is. But it's like 95-98% black in terms of people who live there. Her situation was that a landlord had come after her because she'd moved out. She had trouble with roaches and bed bugs, couldn't get the landlord to address it, finally broke her lease. But then the landlord came after her, tacking on to the back rent that she owed, like $5,000 worth of collection fees and attorney's fees and that kind of stuff.
So it was $7,000 finally.
Right, which is just impossible for her to deal with. And she was being faced with having her wages garnished. I mean, so in the background, she has like $20,000 in student loans that she's just not even really able to deal with. But that wasn't why she ended up in bankruptcy. And I think that's kind of typical in that it's part of the mosaic of things people are dealing with, but it's usually not the pressure point that causes the emergency.
In her case, weren't her wages garnished by the
– She was threatened with that prospect. Uh-huh. And so she was, you know, in a situation thinking about, okay, there's already not enough money to go around to pay rent, to keep the lights on, to keep food on the table. So that's why she...
So she found an attorney named Arthur Ray. He advertised that he charged zero attorney fees. Did he actually advertise on television?
No, he's not one of the ones on TV. There's a couple of the big attorneys there who are always on TV. But he's not. I pointed out what she ended up Googling, bankruptcy attorney Memphis or something like that, and then she ended up on his website, and he says very prominently on his website, $0 down to start. Again, it's a large fee if you end up staying in the plan. She would have paid $3,000, but to get it started, it was nothing.
Now, would Chapter 7 have been an option for Navasha Miller?
Yeah, in her case, I mean, so if you're looking at someone's being forced, facing a wage garnishment, typically Chapter 7 would be the thing that would best address that, because those are typically debts that are wiped out through Chapter 7. She also had this loan on her car that would have been kind of a hairy thing, but I think if she had a good attorney, she definitely could have gotten out, and she'd be in a much different situation now.
But she wound up with this guy.
She ended up failing out like so many people do within 6 months. She switched jobs, and there was some miscommunication with her attorney in terms of getting the payments set up on the Chapter 13. So she failed out, and now she's kind of in a waiting game, I think. If this company comes after her to garnish her again, she'll probably consider bankruptcy again.
But I get the feeling that she didn't understand that she had this Chapter 7 option.
No, she didn't. She told me she didn't know what the difference was. So I was the first one to really explain it to her.
I heard y'all ain't hitting in North Carolina.
Even as we remain mindful of the mass shootings in Las Vegas, we also consider local happenings around North Carolina. Here in Greensboro, the process is underway to rename a street that bears the name of a former governor and white supremacist leader, Charles Aycock. He has also led one of the leaders of the 1898 coup in Wilmington, North Carolina. And here to fill us in is WUNC Greensboro reporter Naomi Prilo. Hello, Naomi.
Hi.
So this is a 2-year effort to rename Aycock Street. Where is this now in the process?
Well, it was just introduced at the last city council meeting, September 19th, by Lewis Brandon, who's with the Beloved Community Center. He had a petition of 400-plus signatures saying we would like this to be renamed to recognize Josephine Boyd. So it should be an agenda item on the next meeting in October 17th, and then we'll see where it goes from there.
Tell us more about Josephine Boyd.
Josephine Boyd was the first black student to graduate from Grimsley High School. She attended in 1957. She was the only black student in a school of 2,000 white students. And this happened, I think, a couple of weeks before Little Rock 9, so she wasn't really recognized as much, but...
Yeah, Greensboro, very interesting for being in the vanguard of many of the protest movements. We know the Woolworth movement preceded what happened in Nashville. You spoke actually with Josephine's sister, Fannie Thompson, and here's what she had to say about renaming the street in her sister's honor.
For her to have endured what she endured, I think that would be a very good way to remember her.
It's Fannie Thompson talking about Josephine Boyd. Tell us more about what she endured as being the first black student in what was by then Grimsley High School.
Yeah, she endured a lot. She was picked on. She had things thrown at her. She was called names, discrimination, tricks being played on her. So it was very tough for her.
Tell us more about Charles Aycock and why we would want to take his name off of a street.
Well, Aycock, I feel like a lot of people are mixed with him because he was such a champion of education, but at the same time, he was white supremacist. So I think a lot of people, from what I've read, have wanted to move past from this.
The governor of North Carolina eventually, who did champion education, of course, for white students only, he was also a fierce champion of segregation, so all of the benefits accrued only to white students, but also one of the architects of the 1898 massacre and coup d'etat, the only successful coup d'etat in American history, where a coalition of black and white politicians were shot out of office, and the federal government did nothing about it, and they were successful in covering that up for about 100 years before finally even the people of North Carolina figured out what actually happened. So in the wake of that kind of knowledge, also served as chief of staff for Woodrow Wilson, interestingly enough, a famous white supremacist himself, Woodrow Wilson was. But anyway, so this conversation, obviously robust. He did things for at least part of the population of North Carolina for which he's remembered. What kind of conversation is going on in Greensboro?
There hasn't really been any type of pushback about renaming Acock Street to possibly Boyd Boulevard. A lot of people are worried about, okay, Boulevard, that means bigger streets. Are we going to have to go through that? Some are saying, okay, is this because it offends somebody? So there's a mixed reaction, but mainly it's been positive because of what Josephine Boyd did.
Got about a minute left, but tell us about a grant that UNCG just received.
Yes, UNCG received a $1.15 million grant from the Department of Education, and it targets first-generation students and underrepresented minority students. And those who are selected, it would be about 25 students, would receive a stipend and research opportunities and GRE prep because it's for students who want to go to grad school.
Go to grad school. Good stuff. Naomi Prilo, WNC Greensboro reporter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For almost 2 weeks, black players in the National Football League have been under an intense spotlight during the national anthem, some standing, some kneeling, and many of them locking arms with their teammates. The silent protests or demonstrations of solidarity have turned off some fans, but as Tanya Mosley of member station KQED in San Francisco reports, many black families are watching closely.
There's one thing you should know about Rob Hughes. He's hopelessly devoted to NFL football. His wife, Joanna, jokes it's his first love.
Eagles, since I met him. Diehard Eagle fan.
He has the Comcast Red Zone Deluxe cable package. It gives him access to every game in the country on his 60-inch television from the comfort of his living room couch. Hughes even checks his fantasy football online during commercial breaks.
If I could have a TV in my bathroom so that I wouldn't have to actually miss a second, I would.
But things have been a little different this season. Hughes pays more attention to the top of the game, the national anthem, what players are kneeling and what players aren't. As we jump in the car to grab some snacks before his beloved Philly Eagles play the Los Angeles Chargers, Hughes explains how he sometimes puts himself in the player's shoes.
Would I kneel? Would I stand? Would I do the patriotic thing as I was taught?
He's not sure. He supports a player's right to protest, no question, and he supports that the protest is against police brutality. Last year, he took his 13-year-old son to Colin Kaepernick's Know Your Rights camp in Oakland. At the time, Kaepernick was a quarterback for the 49ers, and he was scrutinized for taking the knee throughout the season during the national anthem.
It took a whole lot of heart for that dude to do that. You also think to myself, like, I wonder if he thought that all this would come from just that one act.
Hughes' son, Kelby, says Kaepernick's camp was life-changing. He learned stuff like how to talk to and deal with law enforcement. But most of all, Kelby says he learned that he has the right to know his rights. Now, when he sits to watch football with his dad, he's thinking about a lot more than a touchdown.
Every time I see a game, that reminds me of people who have knelt and people who have at least tried to solve our problems in our country.
Some of the family's friends are boycotting the NFL by not watching the games. They feel Kaepernick hasn't been hired for political reasons. But Hughes doesn't want to do that.
You have to also, boycott everybody that supports him. So I got to boycott Visa. I got to boycott Pepsi. I got to boycott all these corporate entities that also do that.
Other people are boycotting the NFL for allowing the players to protest during the anthem. This frustrates Hughes' wife, Joanna.
It's not about the flag. It's about police brutality. That's the way I take it as.
Touchdown. Touchdown.
This week, the Eagles beat the Chargers. Hughes took note during the anthem as the camera focused on Eagles safety Malcolm Jenkins raising his fist. For NPR News, I'm Tanya Mosley in San Leandro, California.
With the first pick in the 2011 NFL Draft, the Carolina Panthers select Cam Newton, quarterback, Auburn.
NFL quarterback Cam Newton is making headlines for his response to a female reporter's question. Let's take a look.
I know you take a lot of pride in seeing your receivers play well. Devin Funchess has seemed to really embrace the physicality of his routes and making getting those extra yards. Does that give you a little bit of an enjoyment to see him kind of truck sticking people out there?
It's funny to hear a female talk about routes. Like, it's funny. But fun is coming along, man. We're gonna. This is a big game for him because of, you know, him being from Detroit.
So that wasn't a particularly funny question. Jordan Rogue was the beat reporter for the Carolina Panthers. She has said on Twitter that she wasn't asking about routes to be funny. She was doing it because it was her job. She also went on to say, because a lot of people were asking, well, did you speak with Cam Newton following this interaction? She said on Twitter, I spoke with him after and it was worse. I chose not to share because I have an actual job to do today and one he will not keep me from. A lot of media organizations have spoken out about Cam's response. People are saying it was very inappropriate. One was the Association for Women in Sports Media. They said the following. AWSM is very discouraged by Cam Newton's disrespectful remarks and actions directed to a female reporter during today's Carolina Panthers press conference. As a watchdog group, AWSM demands fair treatment and positive workplace environments for women working in sports media. Now, a lot of people that I've seen online, I talked about this with the TYT sports team, who are excellent. Please check out their channel. Are saying, well, what is the importance of having female representation in a male-dominated industry? Well, let's just remember that nearly 50% of NFL fans are women, so they should be represented there, because without fans, you don't have a league. And then also, it's worth noting that Dannon has decided they will not renew a contract with him. I've heard it reported that Dannon dropped him. That's not the case. They're just not renewing their contract. And now, with that said, we have an all-female panel today to discuss why these remarks are inappropriate and disrespectful. What was your response when you saw this? Were you surprised?
Well, I don't know anything about him, so was I surprised? No. When people were mentioning his name, I'm like, I don't know who that guy is. So I didn't know anything about his background. And the reason why I say I'm not surprised is because, you know, that mentality still exists in the sports world, where it's like surprising to some people that women are interested in sports, that women want to report on sports. And I'm also not surprised because it involves an NFL player, and the culture around the NFL, even considering the fact that 50% or half of their viewers are women and half of their consumers are women, more importantly, they still try to back their players when in domestic assault cases. Those stories were running rampant a couple years ago. They back their players when it comes to most situations like this, and they'll try to brush it under the rug. And even today, I forget which NFL official it was. I apologize. But I was listening to his statement, and he essentially said, you know, he kind of brushed it off and then said, but, you know, I'd rather talk about this upcoming game, and immediately talked about the upcoming game. So, look, I think it's important to consider that in a lot of households, the female has a considerable amount of buying power. She budgets the money. I'm not saying that that's the most important thing to consider, but for those of you who are like, oh, whatever, who cares? Don't hurt. You're hurting some people's feelings. It's not a big deal. Well, it will hurt your bottom line. So if you think it's not that big of a deal, I mean, we'll see how that turns out when, you know, your ticket sales decrease and your merchandise sales decrease. And then one other thing. Someone had mentioned to me, I was debating a man over this. And he's like, I don't think that's what he meant. I was like, okay, so what did he mean? And I'm curious, does anyone have an answer for that? Because the individual I was debating couldn't give me an answer.
About what his potential intention could have been by
like,
laughing?
What was he implying by laughing?
I don't know. I mean, what I would think is that he probably is interviewed a lot by men who are not professional football players. Now, it'd be different if she was playing an armchair quarterback and saying, oh, you missed that throw. Like, I could have done that. You know, people do that sometimes. It's not good reporting. That's not what she did. She asked a very legitimate question. And if you were to have said that Jordan is actually a pretty gender neutral name, say that Jordan was a man, I don't think that he would have found the question as funny, even though, you know, she maybe, or he or she doesn't have any football experience. Does that make sense? I think the only thing that I could think of is that he's laughing at a reporter
asking a question that he presumes she'd have no experience over, but you don't need to have played the sport to have extensive knowledge of
it. No, dude, oh, yeah, he specifically mentioned female. His wording was so specific, I just find it funny that a female is mentioning routes.
All right, yeah. Would it have been different if he had said, I just find it funny that a reporter is asking me about routes. What do you know about routes? You haven't played the game. Would this be a news story?
Maybe some people would make it a news story, but I don't think that it would be as clear. And yeah. I don't even know if we would ever talk about
it. Yeah, most reporters haven't played. You know what I mean? That's why they were reporting, you know? So yeah. I think the story is the obvious sexism. What bothers me is that he laughs in her face.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like, it's just disrespectful. It's stupid.
So condescending.
It's really condescending and it's stupid. And to your point about the bottom line, you know, you lost a yogurt endorsement. Bitches eat yogurt. Like, you gotta pay attention to who, you know what I mean? Like, what are you doing?
But he still signed Under Armour, and Under Armour, like, they're not gonna budge. Like, he still has other endorsements.
Yeah, Under Armour is also problematic for different reasons. But, you know, I will say that this whole story is a good lesson in intersectionality, in that it did come out that this reporter, in her background, has some unsavory, mm-hmm. potentially racist tweets.
Yeah.
So then now the conversation is about, you know, racist and he's sexist, right? Like, again, my point, my motto is that two things can be true. Everybody needs to get their politics together. Mm-hmm. Cam, NFL, get your gender politics together.
And another thing that when we were covering the story that I asked our sports team about, that they brought up, is that there's a little bit of a double standard. They cited Rob Gronkowski is another NFL player, and they're saying that he's made sort of inappropriate remarks to reporters, female reporters, and I don't know the specifics of those statements, but I trust Jason Rubin very much, and he said that, you know, when he does that, he's being playful, he's messing around. Now Cam Newton makes this remark, which is, again, it's still disrespectful, and he comes under national media scrutiny.
Sure.
And we don't see that carried over. Rob Gronkowski is a white player, just for reference.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, right.
Sure, all of this is racialized. I mean, our president is not under scrutiny, doesn't fall under the same kind of scrutiny. And he's said awful things about women. Mm-hmm. But I do think, again, that two things can be true, that, like, if we don't want to be disrespected, let's work on our politics, our race politics, our gender politics, our politics around sex, right? Like, we need to be better. And I think that it's interesting that these two things kind of come to the fore at the same time.
You probably know who Cam Newton is. He plays quarterback for the Carolina Panthers in the NFL, and he's a very lively personality. On Wednesday, when asked a question about running routes on the football field, he stood back and said to a reporter, "It's funny to hear a female talk about routes. Like, it's funny." First off, female is an adjective, not a noun. So, if you find yourself using that word as a noun, understand that what you're doing is sexist. If you're having trouble understanding, it's sort of like calling black folks blacks, as if somehow we aren't people too. She's a female reporter. That's her job. Not to mention, one need not be a man to understand football. How do I know? Because many dudes I know don't understand anything about the game whatsoever. This idiotic notion that you have to have played it or have a member to understand how to cover it is absurd. To review, calling a woman a female is sexist, and laughing at a professional trying to do their job is ridiculous. I'm Clinton Yates, and that's my take.
The second time I met O.J. Simpson.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, October 7th, 2017. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts on any of the news clips that we just heard. If you have counter-racist suggestions, observations you'd like to share, feel free. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-543-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. A couple quick things before we get to the callers. First of all, we are listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, look in the top right corner. You'll see the button for our PayPal. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported the cows for nearly a decade. I hope we have been and continue to be worthy of your time and energy. You can also support if you are not into the PayPal and all that. You can also support us at Amazon.com, my wish list under Gus T. Renegade. It is also linked on the blog. I posted it on my Facebook page as well this evening. Thanks for all the folks who have nabbed items. In fact, that is how I got my copy of the book we are going to be starting this Friday, Neil Postman's Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk. The subtitle, How We Defeat Ourselves by the Way We Talk and What to Do About It. I read this book the same year that the cow started in 2007. This was content that I was reading just before I was able to talk to Mr. Fuller for the first time, get his book, all of that. This was some of the content that I was looking at, just talking about words and really paying attention to the way that we use words. A lot of constructive information in this book from my memory, and we'll be starting it on Friday. But I got my copy of this out of print book by putting it on my Amazon wish list and got hooked up. I'm so thankful. But yeah, check it out. Nab anything there. Thank you kindly. Other things that I wanted to get to before we get to the callers. Let's see. First up, in the segment where they were reporting on the black families who were watching the game, the NFL games or what have you, and they reported from San Leandro, California. I used to live there, San Leandro specifically. And in fact, I was told San Leandro was nicknamed Clan Leandro. A white person told me this because San Leandro is right next to Oakland, California, for people, if you don't know Bay Area, California geography. But they said that a lot of white people, that was the quote unquote white flight spot. Once the Black Panther Party, which started right next door in Oakland, and you had a lot of activist activity from black people during the 60s and 70s, that a lot of whites, they fled the Negros, and San Leandro was one of those spots. They said, in fact, it used to be you would hardly ever see a black person, a non-white person in San Leandro. And I still felt that when I lived out there, not that long ago, when I lived out there, I used to get stopped. I got stopped in a 6-month time period. I got stopped 3 times by enforcement officers within like a 4-block radius of my residence. For the most, you know, ridiculous of all things. Daylight, didn't matter. Daylight, sun could be down, didn't matter at all. And in fact, I had my white landlord tell me that our lovely San Leandro neighbors would see me out and about in the neighborhood, and they came and reported to her. And I think she even said some of the non-white people even came to her and were like, oh, my Lord, did you see the Negro in the neighborhood? Who is he? I bet he's peddling drugs or something. And she said she had to fuss at them and be like, that Negro is fine. He is my friend. You leave him alone. He is not selling drugs and all of that. But yes, I'm very familiar with Clan Leandro. Next, the whole Cam Newton kerfuffle, man, black male privilege again, I guess, for him to sit up there and lob insults from the podium. I'm glad that people rifled through her social media feed, the reporter who allegedly was wronged by Cam Newton. I'm glad they rifled through her social media feed to find the racist commentary that her father allegedly said, and she's talking about this online. She's since come out and offered her a little tacky, you know, typical apology about it. But everything about that situation, particularly people chiding him for even the use of the term female. Gus T, I use the term female and male exactly as guided by Mr. Fuller in the Word Guide. I think I've been using those two terms as nouns before, and I will continue to do so. Gus T. also has been chided exclusively for using the term female. I have never, ever, ever been chided for using the term male. Never. That right there I find to be a problem. It would seem like you would have uniform complaints that if there's something wrong with using female as a noun, there should also be something wrong about using male as a noun. I've never heard that critique. Folks can say whatever they would like about his commentary. I will say it is a little odd hearing as many females doing the reporting now. I think the NFL's new scheme of how they want to get and keep watchers, viewers, I think they've been implementing this for, I don't know, maybe the last 10 years or so, is to have more and more female commentators and on-air personalities for the games. That is odd. I think anyone, if you watched football, oh my goodness, I'd say anytime before the 2000s, like that is not something that was a common occurrence. So it wouldn't shock me at all if you would have people say, oh, that's a little unusual or a little strange. This is not something that, you know, I'm accustomed to seeing or getting these type of questions. But at any rate, I thought that was another striking example of how non-white people, and I would say black males specifically, especially end up being targeted by accusations of sexism, feminism. That doesn't say that black males have never done anything to wrong females, but certainly I think in the system of racism, white supremacy, a lot of the conversation around the black male sexist and black male privilege, I think a lot of that is white supremacist rhetoric. And it's not based in reality at all. I'm very open to, you know, other commentary or feedback. And I'm even reminded President Trump said, made his comments and made it all the way to the White House about grab him in the nether regions. Next up, I thought it was interesting, the commentary that Mumia Abu-Jamal offered, where he was talking about the shooting in Las Vegas. I thought that was interesting. He certainly has VGQ, like, you know, other non-white people, any other non-white person, but I do find it interesting, any of the commentary around, that interesting is not even the correct word. I find it difficult to accept that as a talking point, as a valid talking point, some sort of conversation about gun laws and restrictions on the type of firearms that whites have access to. That is obvious. You can gun down a school full of children. Anyone, anybody, crowd of country music goers, doesn't matter. Whites are not turning loose of their phallic symbol. Dr. Welsing talked about this consistently. And just, I mean, speaking honestly for Gus T., I get tired. It's difficult for me to even hear commentary about this, that this is somehow white people being scared. The NRA has too much power. In my view, that is just not understanding racism, white supremacy. Everyone should get Dr. Welsing's The ISIS Papers and reflect on some of the different times that she's talked about these mass shootings and how that fits into her theory of white genetic annihilation and why whites are so attached to their great equalizer. Next, I think we talked about this last week. I know it was significant for me, left an impression on me, and I don't have children. The incident in Utah where the non-white father, his child was being terrorized by some white brute, and the non-white parent went out to challenge the race soldier, and the racist had a stun gun after he'd been calling this 7-year-old a nigger, pulled out a stun gun and stunned the non-white parent in the neck in front of his child. Well, this week you heard pregnant black mother out with her other children and being accosted by some white woman. I think that's important as well, because a lot of times we get, you know, confused about all of this. There's your victim of sexism and feminism right there. But the white woman, I think, at least I didn't see the video, but I think someone who could be white out harassing, terrorizing this pregnant black female and her children. And just, we talked about this last week, in my view, and again, I don't have children, but in my view, and this would be the code, even if you don't have children, if you are anywhere and you start hearing whites or even an individual white yelling, nigger this, and what are you niggas doing around here, and all that sort of terroristic language, I would leave immediately. To me, those are danger signs. That is a warning. White people are extremely dangerous, and it does not take a lot of time. We've talked about that before, done whole programs on that. It can be seconds sometimes before, whoa, my life is in jeopardy. When you start hearing that, in my view, and particularly, especially if you have children, maybe if you, I've heard some people, if that's your code and, you know, I get challenged in an aggressive manner like that, I'm going into counter violent self-defense. Fine. But if you have children, I don't think that you want to take too many chances with your offspring present. I think the best code, if you have offspring present, would be to leave immediately. Don't record, don't video, to get out of that environment immediately. And then you can, if you want to call the enforcement officials or whomever else, get yourself out of that environment. It is extremely dangerous, and we should take that seriously. I said the same thing about recording. I don't know if folks recall, but I think this was two summers ago. There was an event in Illinois, some sort of festival or something, and it was a black male. He was with his girlfriend or wife, I believe. It, again, a white woman came up, started calling them nigger. I think she spit on them. I mean, just really, really ugly scene. And he pulled out his cell phone, the black male, and began recording her terroristic behavior. And that just amplified. She just, you know, really turned up now. Like, oh, you want to record? I'm going to give you something to record. And I've seen that before where you pull out the camera and, you know, it does not solve the problem. It can make things way worse. I know it can be great to record, but sometimes you need to recognize when you are in mortal danger and to get yourself out of that situation immediately. Last thing I'll get in. Did anybody hear? Very interested in feedback, because I know we have listeners in Tennessee as well. Nashville, I think, especially, we have listeners there. Did anyone hear about Emmanuel Cadega Sampson? That's the black male who's the alleged shooter, the Nashville church shooting that happened in September. It was reported a little over a week ago that he had some sort of note in his vehicle that was saying the shooting that he's reported to have carried out and killed a white woman, shot some others, was retaliation for Dylan Storm Roof's 2015 terrorist attack at Mother Emanuel AME. Did anybody hear about that? I thought that was really, really, or two things I can end here. Two things that I thought were significant this week. No coincidences. That shooting happened, black male shooter at a church where he actually killed a white woman. And I did not hear a lot of conversation about that, especially this week, in tying that, connecting that with the Vegas shooting. I didn't hear that. Maybe I missed it. I really didn't hear a whole lot about it at all. And I especially didn't hear a whole lot about this is retaliation for Dylan Storm Roof. Now, they did have it in the New York Times. I saw it on a few other outlets and some of the smaller, what they would call, I guess, conservative, right wing, Breitbart type outlets. They did mentioned this, and they did say that they thought the quote unquote mainstream media was downplaying this and this wasn't getting attention. If, you know, standard rhetoric, if a black person had done, if a white person had done such a thing, it would have got more coverage. But I didn't hear a lot about that at all. Just curious if folks did hear about that or if people even have any thoughts. If you also think that this might be something that's not getting a lot of coverage, why is that? Particularly in, you know, this climate with President Trump and everything that's going down. I'll hush there. Number again, 641-715-3640 and the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. One thing that I will say quickly, as I say for all of our compensatory call-ins, metaphors. I had a lovely listener contact me this week, and she said, and many others have said this, that I know you don't like metaphors, or I know you hate metaphors. I don't have a personal vendetta with metaphors, analogies, similes. That is not the case, not at all. But what I do say is that I have seen where a lot of times racists, whites, they will use metaphors, comparisons, similes, analogies. They will contrast things that are not equivalent. They'll say, oh, yeah, this is like this. They'll say that, but that's not the case. That's one of the, in my view, that is one of the pivotal ways that they practice deception, racism, making these inaccurate, false comparisons. victims, non-white people, we've been exposed to that behavior for a long time, and we are still learning, Gus T. Renegade included. I have found that frequently non-white people, victims of racism, will use metaphors, analogies, when they have not really come to a conclusion that they can succinctly, logically articulate to someone who will understand what it is they're trying to say. I have found that frequently they will substitute metaphors or analogies when they have not got all the data, logic necessary to present their case, and that is not acceptable. If you can't adequately explain something where you have to substitute and bring in something else totally different that you can't explain, that is not acceptable, and it might mean that you need to do more thinking, which is fine. Just we should be cautious about that. And for this program, we should make sure we are precise with what we're saying. So no metaphors. I'll prompt about that. Thank you kindly. With that, folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, or the first few folks you dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Hello, can I be heard? Go ahead, sister.
Thank you. Greetings, everybody. There was a few of the clips that I wanted to comment on. I was actually thinking earlier this week about the word intersectionality and about the whole concept. I've been indoctrinated with it, so like it was something that we're supposed to use, a word that's supposed to make sense, but I get it, but I think that it's stupid talk. I don't think that it speaks to anything real. And I've been listening to the clips. I didn't know anything about it. I'm one of the females who don't know anything about sports, and I'm okay with that. But in listening to the females talking about it, there for me, the way I interpret the use of feminism or any other form of oppression that's not racism, but being tied to racism as a form of extrapolation, that racism is a very specific type of oppression that none of the other types of oppression fit into or can use to find any kind of justification or anything, but they're all doing it. We've talked about it before, but I definitely felt that in that clip that and actually in a lot of the clips when we're talking about racism or when racism is being addressed, and that it always sounds like children are talking. Such and such said this, and it's hurting my feelings or something. And so we're never actually addressing racism. It's just become a I don't want to use a metaphor, but when it becomes, it's just a, anyway, moving on, because I can't figure out exactly how to say that. I don't think anything was wrong with his comment. I really don't. And I don't think that he meant it in a derogatory way. It didn't even sound like, when I heard it, I was like, what's the big deal? And I think it should be viewed in context. And I think that just the climate of everything has making everyone feel like they have some kind of thing to say, that we can't just address racism. Everybody has to have some type of oppression, and they're all being oppressed. Everybody's oppressing everybody. And that's not true. Gun control is not going to stop the violence. I don't want to sound cliche, but I won't even say it. Just what they're calling gun control is not going to stop the violence. And then the comment that was, I think the university's name is Macy or Massey, where they have the master is like the president or dean or something like that. That was racist. And I don't even know why that was a conversation and then the last thing I want to say is that I'm being reminded of the book by George Orwell, 1984, with all of the renaming of the streets and the taking down of the monuments. It's appearing or feeling a lot like an erasure of history, which was like a real big theme in that book. I think that they should stay. Not that it matters what I think, but I don't think that changing the names or taking down the monuments is going to stop the system of racism or help in any way, shape, or form. It's only going to make it more confusing and allow whites to practice their deception even better. Thank you for listening.
Something to think about from our book club, George Orwell, 1984. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hello, everyone. This is Isaac in Delaware. Just want to follow up on or just add to what Gus was talking about in regards to avoiding situations where, you know, you have irate white people screaming.
Oh, are you still with us, sir? Isaac, are you still there, sir? Not hearing. I don't know if you got disconnected. The last thing that I heard, you said irate white people screaming, and then the sound cut out. So if you got disconnected, we will look for you on the switchboard. Hopefully everything is all right. While we are waiting, I guess, to see what happened with Isaac, other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Yeah, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, greetings, Gus and callers. I also had that same experience in San Leandro, by the way. But
which one? Which experience?
That random profiling.
Oh.
The police did not, you know, if they see a black face, they don't play. Well, this was back in the 90s, but yeah. But my commentary on the bank, as far as a bankruptcy, you know, I'm letting my business out in the street, but yeah, I filed my own bankruptcy. You can do it yourself. And if you ever do come to the point where you need to do that, you just go to the federal courthouse. And it costs like maybe $350 or something. You get a big stack of paperwork, and most of it will not apply to you. You fill it out. You can do it yourself. You don't need an attorney. And it's kind of a tedious process, but if you want to, you can. I mean, if you need to, you can definitely do it yourself. You don't need an attorney. You don't, you know. And the only thing is that 95% of the time, what you're doing is challenging whoever your creditor is and telling them to come to court, and 95% of the time they will never come, and it's not the way that guy was saying it. It's you can do it yourself. You can do it pro bono, so pro se. I'm sorry, not pro bono, pro se. So I just wanted to add that, and thank you for taking my call.
Awesome. Did you file Chapter 7, Chapter 13? How did you file?
Yeah, I did a 7.
Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, as far as like your assets and everything, I mean, you can't. It is kind of like you can't have your cake and eat it too. But
metaphor, like, very important metaphor, because this is one where details are important.
My apologies. You can't have it both ways. You can't like keep certain things and then be excused from it debt wise, but you can definitely do it yourself. The Chapter 7, and actually after you do it, everybody wants to. It's like you're like a college student. Everybody wants to give you credit again as soon as you file. Like everybody's gonna come for you to like get cars, and don't do that. But that's my contribution. Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely.
Man, hurt.
Yes, ma'am, Red. I just wanted to thank the caller for sharing, because like this is similar to workplace racism. Is not necessarily the most fun thing to talk about financial trouble that we've had, but that I'm sure is information that some folks listening definitely will look into. So thank you for sharing, sir. Red in Ohio, sorry for the interruption. Proceed.
Oh, thank you, and I apologize for interrupting you. Thank you for taking my call, and hello to everyone. Try to make this as quick as possible. There is the Whitehaven story about the non-white female, I think the black female, and also about the the debts or the bankruptcy filing. What triggered a thought in my mind, I'm sorry, what made me think about or consider that story was the non-white female who I'm associated with and her apartment issues. And I actually have an update. So just really quick, the apartment that she was supposed to move into, the Section 8 apartment, I guess what they call it here, government assistance. She was supposed to move into that. I helped her move, and there were roaches everywhere, alive and dead, all types of things wrong, the cabinets and shower, like mildewed, everything like that. So she moved out. And when she was moving out, the white office person, the white woman who worked in the office, very rude. And of course they wouldn't refund her any of her money, even though she didn't spend one night there. So apparently what the update is that the management company, they apparently had fired all of the old office staff, and they have, hired new office or brought in other office staff from other affiliates of their company. And there was this black woman who had reached, or I'm sorry, black female who had reached out to the black female who I know to try to get her to move back in, and they had fixed everything. So it seemed like the black person who was working with the black female that I know was a lot nicer. And they were actually able to, you know, what they said was to get all the roaches out and also to replace everything that should have been replaced in the first place. So that was a quick update on that. My story that I have to contribute, because I do look at like the Columbus Dispatch a lot that I get like from my family members. And while I was trying to look for more stories about fentanyl, and they actually have not been having them lately, I came across a story, and it's the title is White Nationalists to Sue Two Schools Over Speaking Rights. And just some quick call outs is that Richard Spencer, he had requested to rent a space on two campuses, the Ohio State University, which is in Columbus, Ohio, the capital of Ohio, and the University of Cincinnati. The University of Cincinnati, he wanted to speak late in October, but it didn't give it an exact date. And he also has, apparently the requests were denied several times, or at least one time. And so he has this lawyer, the lawyer's name, which I felt like was really important, and I'm glad they talked about it in the article. His name is Kyle Bristow. He is the founder of a law firm dedicated to legal advocacy on the behalf of the so-called, and this is what it says in the article, the so-called alt-right, a loose connection of white nationalists, white supremacists, and anti-immigration populists. And he said either they host him or they will get sued. And apparently that's one of the new things that Richard Spencer and this his white supremacist lawyer is doing. So they had sued the University of Auburn, or I'm sorry, Auburn University, and because they wouldn't let him speak there. And it says the judge ruled against Auburn, which was then who then allowed Richard to speak, or planned an event to speak there. Trying to make this really quick. There's also the thing that I can't understand, and they don't really explain it in the article, is that a student named Cameron Paget, and the student is from Georgia State University. From my understanding, I haven't heard of a Georgia State University in Ohio, so I'm not sure as to why it would matter that much. A Georgia State University student trying to have this white supremacist booked at two different Ohio universities in Ohio. The last call out, because I'm sorry, I'm not sure how I am doing on time. When they were describing Richard Spencer, I'll just read this quick sentence. Spencer, a leading figure in the white nationalist movement, has advocated for the ethnostate that would be a safe place for white people. He helped organize the rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in August that resulted in violence and the death of a woman protesting there. So, of course, as I stated several shows ago when the Charlottesville rally actually happened. It seems like, Heather Heyer's mother, I'm assuming she's now part of the Mothers of the Movement, and it doesn't matter about the black male who was injured, brutally injured, and all the other people who were injured. It's only the only outcome of that whole rally was that a white woman was killed. Thank you for allowing me to share, and I'll mute my line.
Indeed. Heather Heyer. One thing I did want to interject really quick, and then the other folks that are on the line can certainly proceed. That clip on the Young Turks, we've been listening to them for years. I talked about that a few weeks ago. That clip stands out especially for a myriad of reasons. The rhetoric around intersectionality and what have you, but they had a key moment, at least for me it was key. It was all females. Yes, I said all females. But they had a black female. And at one point she said a B word, B-I-T-C-H, eat yogurt, implying that Cam Newton's commentary would, somehow upset female yogurt consumers. He lost his Dannon, or I said, I think it was the specifics. They're not going to renew his Dannon yogurt contract. Things like that, that are on television, even though this is a streamed video content, things like that, it would not surprise me if that was directly scripted by racists. Like, oh yeah, say this, that'll be funny, because that has happened. I think W. Kamau Bell, he wrote about being on Bill Maher when he was prompted that they wanted him to speak first to talk about an issue about racism. It was four or five, maybe even more than that, people on the panel, but they had already told him, they staged, we want you to speak first on this issue. This, I think, also could have been prompted, go ahead and say this line. Maybe not. And it also would not surprise me. It's very easy with the way that we have been brain trashed to find a black victim, male or female, who would say that sort of thing and think it's funny, be the entertainment committee for whites, to find someone like that. Oh, we'll give you a job, but you can say it. Just make sure you say it at this point, whether they come up with it organically, the victim comes up with it organically themselves, or if race soldiers write it out. Oh yeah, you want to keep the job? Say that here. It struck me as finger. Well, I won't even say it as a metaphor. It struck me very much as tacky and trashy, and it reminded me of the type of functioning and the way that racists think. But yeah, it was a black female who said that in the clip, and that also, the standard with the Young Turks. Other folks we've not heard from, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Right, greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. This is Henry from Chicago. I wanted to thank you for the interview you did with Walter Beach on Wednesday. I thought it was a very good interview he had with you. Very good interactions, and talks about racism in sports and society in all cases. So thanks for that. And in regards to the Tennessee church shooting, one thing that was weird about it was the shooting happened on the 24th of September, but the note that was discovered was not reported until October 4th. So I was reading the report about it, and it was talking about how the Associated Press, who reported this, had not viewed the note, but it was summarized by law enforcement officials that it was some sort of, when they talked about the note, I guess, to the press, that it suggested that it was revenge for the Dylan, the Charleston shooting. So I'm kind of suspicious on that. In regards to that, because I remember when Dylan Roof had did his when Dylan Roof had did his killing, the manifestos, like popped up immediately. And I know he had a website, but he also had a written manifesto that was like posted online not too far off after he did that. So I'm kind of suspicious on this one. So, cause you can't find, you know, you can't find anything outside of what this AP report says about what the note contained. So suspicious races, you know, probably planted the note or whatever, but I'll just keep it at that. But that's all I had for now. Mute my line.
That is an important point that they don't have a photograph of this alleged note. It was summarized, as was stated, by a suspected race soldier. But it was released before October 4th. I posted it online on October 1st, and the New York Times had it September 29th. So it's been out for a little over a week. They had it right at the end of last month. It was posted about the this alleged note and the connection to the Charleston massacre. But I still haven't heard very much about it. That's why I was curious if any of you all have heard anything about it. Other folks that we have not heard from at all have commentary. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to everyone. The first thing I'll go to what I think is the probably most important thing that I will report on. As far as water safety and or swimming is concerned, from my background, I have unfortunately assisted pulling a lot of dead non-white black people out of pools, lakes, canals. For the most part, when it comes on the news about a child that tragically drowned in a household pool, 99% of the time down here in South Florida, it's a black child. Parents, caretakers of children, underestimate on how quickly an energetic child can get into water, whether it's a pool that's in a house of, let's say, you know, you're at a party at a guest and they have a pool and there's a lot of people around, and but it could happen in seconds where the child would drown. Get your child drown proofed as early as possible. The connection, we're all are born in water. We all are in our mother's body in water. So when we come out as children, we are still familiar with that experience. Before, as long as the time is elongated, where the fear would set in. So the sooner the better, as far as that concerned. Also going to, even with everybody else other than just children, in your car. I know that some of the listeners are not necessarily in a environment like I am in South Florida, where it's a, you know, culture of water. But there are floods in a lot of places that are not known for water. And you're driving in your car, you may think that you know that a body of water that's behind this place where you visit, that you can spot it in a flood, but you won't. And you may find yourself in your car with the windows rolled up in serious trouble. You can go to your local fire department and they can tell you about the cutter that you can get for your seatbelt, and also a it's kind of like a what they call a hole puncher that you can bust out your window in order to get yourself out of your car if you're in a flooded situation. Things that, you know, most of us don't even think about can end up saving your life in a brief period of time. Moving on, I have down here about Cam Newton. He's been sought after by white people in a negative way probably since he was coming out of high school as a college student. I can recall at Florida, the trouble that he got into, and it may have had something to do with the rival with the white football player, I forget his name, that you know, was always expounding this religion all the time. Tim Tebow. From my experience as a football player and a football coach for a very long time, since 1970, I would say that Cam Newton is a far better athlete and football player than this person. But they found a way to settle that. And Cam Newton had, of course, we all know, had to leave Florida and eventually surfaced again at Auburn to show you on how great of a football player that he actually is. I would tell you from the football standpoint that the prototypical quarterback is the person that can throw the ball as well as have athleticism enough to do other things if he can't throw the football. So therefore, somebody like Cam Newton is a top type of person that's sought after. And in turn, a lot of trouble also comes this way because they want to try to eliminate, you know, him, you know, and because that's always something. Mr. Beach talked about it briefly with the restrictions that was on blacks during the time when he was playing. I don't have enough time to expound on it. And with the group that I associate with on this program, you guys don't care that much about it anyway, you know, in a sense, but it is a direct racial, connection, with the positions and who, that they're going to, allow to stay in the NFL or they're going to get rid of. And Cam is always going to be right in the middle of something like that from the position that he plays and how good of a football player he is. I did hear about the shooting last week, and it was reported that the non-white black male who did the shooting, who allegedly did the shooting, did do it as a revenge for the shootings that took place I forgot where it was, but I'm sure everybody knows where that most shooting was with the white male. I have, last but not least, I've had here that, oh yeah, that white people would never, never, ever, ever. You would know that there is a ending of the system of racist white supremacy when white people would become disarmed. I'll just put it that way. They're never going to cease with their arms because it's a vital part of the enforcement part of racist white supremacy. That's the logical reasoning on that, which assists white people in practicing something called direct violence. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Indeed. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you guys, to all the other callers and listeners. I wanted to say a great show thus far and great contributions from everybody. I wanted to touch on some of the clips. What I found interesting about the clip on the situation in Puerto Rico, they were talking about the drug manufacturing, but something that I've only seen in a few places is the fact that the vast majority of people's hedge funds, which is basically what's running a lot of people's pensions in this country, was held by Puerto Rico. And before the storm, they were $70 billion in debt. So a lot of people's pension money is really locked in that situation, and that money would have went towards paying the debt, and a lot of people are not going to get their pensions. Over the last few months, I don't know if people have been noticing, but there have been different states that have been filing for bankruptcy and not paying state workers' pensions at all. So a lot of that is tied up in what was going on in Puerto Rico before everything happened as far as the storm. So things are really, really bad as far as that's concerned. There's a lot that's going to come behind what's going on in Puerto Rico as far as the financial situation in this country, because of the fact that the hedge funds, the vast majority of them, were held and operated out of Puerto Rico before the storm. Also, the clip that you played on Massey College, I just found it very interesting that when they were speaking to the, I guess he was a professor, and he basically defended the white racist who said what he said. Before he went into this dissertation on how he completely disagreed with what he said. And to me, it was more of, it just came across as rhetorical ethics to me, because if he's wrong, he's wrong. What he said was racist, and he tried to downplay it to say that, oh, I just think he was he made a bad decision to say what he said. You don't make a bad decision, or something to that effect. It's not a bad decision to be racist. It's what white people are. And then for him to go and say that he was against it in such vehement terms, when you just defended the same person and their racist behavior just 2 seconds earlier, is like a great display of rhetorical ethics, in my opinion. And hopefully a lot of non-white people saw through that, those people who got to see that particular clip. The clip on Howard University, there was a section that was where it was said that the white person had said that it's not a crime if the people you kill are black. And that ties into the black codes. And I've always said it, the black codes is still on the law books here, which means basically to be black or to be termed as black in the system automatically makes you a criminal. And essentially, that's what he's speaking about, that if you kill a black person, you're not killing anyone of note, because it's legally okay to kill us. That's why we see the police doing it. That's why we see it happening with just regular average white people. That's why that horrible, I'm sorry to hear that pregnant black female and her two children had to be accosted and terrorized like that. But that's the reason why these things are happening. It's because it's still legal. It's a legal thing that they can still do to us. And every so often, there's some reference made to that, and that was an overt reference, in my opinion, to that. In reference to the Vegas shooting, I don't know if you have found out or heard anything about it, Gus, but there were multiple shooters. There was a reported incident of the Flamingo and the Bellagio lobbies both being shot up at the same time that the shooting in the crowd was taking place. And they found that different caliber weapons were used at those locations. So I think it's just starting to really come out in the past few days that they're thinking it's more than one shooter. But I had heard about it almost from the very beginning. So just something to look for as far as the developments of what's happening with that. In reference to the clip on Tennessee and the bankruptcy situation, man, I think that is one of the best examples of white supremacy working very well in that area, to have so many large numbers of black people in such a state of poverty that they have to file bankruptcy just to keep the lights on and just for basic necessities and basic survival. To me, that is just it just shows that the way that they have the system set up there, it is just by design to keep black people in a position where they can't get anywhere. It's just I could see them trying to spread that model to other states and other areas just simply because of how successfully it's working there, sadly. Wow. I think that's it for now. I had something else, but I'll give somebody else a chance to speak. I think I used up my 5 minutes. Thank you, and I'll read my line.
Sure. Get the number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Folks we've not heard from at all. Appreciate that, Roz. Folks we've not heard from at all. If you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. This is Mhandisi. I wanted to call about, I heard Mr. Neely Fuller before. He said that, I believe he said that we didn't have a list of all the white supremacists, of who's a white supremacist and who's not. And I understand what he's saying, but my mindset, I'm pretty sure that all white people are white supremacists. So, you know, a list would be Facebook. I believe Facebook has just about all the white people, aside from the babies. They have them all on Facebook. And if we wanted to number how many white people were actually on the earth, we could use the social media. And that would be something that, you know, maybe one of our black think tanks, I think maybe the Harvest Institute might be the only one I've heard of, you know, but we could figure out how many white people there are so we can know how many white supremacists there are. So then we can know who we're disarming and who exactly we're talking about. And if we have, for some reason, can't figure out from looking at them who's a white person, who's not, we can just look at the content and you'll be able to identify who is classifying as white and who's not, and look at their parents and their associates and all that sort of thing. And then the other thing is for the African Union, I think the African Union has to intervene with what's going on in the world and what's going on here in America. Korea's talking about, I believe, or at least the TV says that Korea is talking about putting a nuke here, a nuclear bomb here in America, which means that people from every single African country would die, and Africa did not prevent it. And Africa may have the ability to stop it. You're a really, really, really big place. That's where all of us come from. So it's Africa's duty to step in and intervene. And but first and foremost, intervene with these white people, these ice albinos. But thank you.
Appreciate that. Other folks, if we have not heard from you at all, you have a hand up, proceed. Did we get everybody? We didn't miss anyone? Nobody who has a hand up that we have missed completely?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. If you could speak up a bit, Mr. Steele.
Yeah, actually, I got to step out of this sauna just a second here.
Pardon us for messing up sauna time.
No, it's not that. I just, there was people in there, and I'm not about to start recording in front of suspected racists. So, all right, I'm in a better place. So, yeah, this week has been very interesting. This is Ken Steele, and I'm recording from Chino, California. And this week basically started with all the suspected racists that I know and that I've encountered. They were on code with respect to the attack that took place in Las Vegas. The overwhelming majority of suspected racists that I've encountered have been very silent overall about the goings-on there. Some have made the joke that they were happy that it was a country music concert and not a rap concert. You know, they would make that joke toward me in hopes that I could, you know, I guess relate to them or how they feel about it. But another thing that was very interesting that I noted about the response to this was that the suspected racist got very, very mathematical when it came to this whole incident. They didn't really, from what I observed, they spent a very brief amount of time pretending to eulogize the victims or have sympathy for the victims. And then after that, they immediately started talking about numbers. The only thing that seemed to matter to them was the body count total, the number of dead. And then it started getting really granular with the math. LA Times, they had a headline that read, what made this attack so deadly? And it, no, it wasn't the fact that you had an armed suspected white supremacist with a semi-automatic firearm that was modified to shoot in an automatic fashion. No, that wasn't it. They said that the reason this was so deadly was trigonometry. So very difficult math was, the reason why this was such a deadly attack. They're even coming out with news reports from the police officers indicating that the shooter had, or the suspected terrorist, I guess, had a book that had numbers in it, and they're trying to say that these numbers were calculations about what angle he should point his gun at to hit a crowd of over 1,000 people with an automatic firearm or semi-automatic firearm. So, you know, they're getting really ridiculous when it comes to their reactions to these incidences. They're getting very, they're making it very clear that they're ready to kill a lot of civilians. And I look at this as kind of a test run. You know, can they pull something off like this with everybody confused? Yes. And then there was a previous caller that was reporting that there were multiple shootings throughout Las Vegas during the incident. This is one of many of the false news stories that have come out of this situation. Another thing that the suspected racist did in reaction to this was they put out a number of false narratives. And this is a strategy that suspected racists have perfected in the Soviet Union and in Russia, the Federal Republic of Russia afterwards. So this, to me, is just, I was really saddened to see so many victims fall for the Alex Jonesian style false flag narratives. No, over 50 people were shot dead in Las Vegas. Over 500 people were injured. This really did happen. All reports of multiple shooters and you know, false flags and all of this, they're unconfirmed. If you try to confirm any of these stories, you don't get any conclusive evidence. At best, you'll get a WordPress website. So please, 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 fellow victims, I urge you, in these situations, do not be quick to give any sort of commentary or counter-narrative or, you know, rumors that you may have heard from people that were on the scene. These are, I suspect, the work of suspected racists to further confuse the discussion. And then the week concluded with the FBI declaring that those of us who, that the new extreme threat in America, the new terrorist threat in America, is black identity extremists. And, you know, their definition of black identity extremists is worded in such a way that it includes all of us on this phone call. And on top of that, you could basically include any black person that has a problem with racism, expresses a problem with white supremacy, or works to fight against it. So, you know, a bunch of white people were killed by a fellow white person, and the week ended with black people being declared as the newest, terrorist identity threat by the FBI. My name is Ken Steele, and I'm just going to go ahead and mute my line right now. I'm disgusted.
Indeed. I could certainly see the church shooting figuring in that narrative. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up we haven't heard from you at all, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir. Was there a female caller also? It was just one person. Oh, all right. Proceed, sir.
Thank you very much. This is V from Central New York. Peace to Gus, peace to all the listeners, peace to your homes, and peace to our communities, which seems to be increasingly under threat more and more each day. I am I'm kind of happy that I waited till this late in the broadcast to speak. I've been busy, actually, so, you know, sometimes things work out how they do. But I was reminded from that church shooting, I hadn't heard much about it, but I started reading information on it on Wednesday, carried through until Thursday and Friday. And I was reminded of this book that I found a couple of years ago called Black Politics, The Inevitability of Conflict by Edward S. Greenberg. It's a book from the early 70s, maybe late 60s. And there's a chapter in it on page 273 titled, actually, it's the introduction to the third section, titled Black Violence as Political Protests. It's an interesting introduction to this section, which offers many intriguing insights by white people as to why black violence has erupted, and not necessarily what could be done to mitigate it or even stop it, but how best to understand it. As the section goes on, they deal with how to mitigate it and stop it. But I think for the benefit of tonight's show, I'm going to read very briefly the beginning of this under the section Violence and Political Scientists. Most political scientists, the author writes, affirm the view that civil violence is irrational behavior unrelated to public policy and is pathological for the political system. This view derives partially from an overly narrow definition of the term political. Until very recently, few American political scientists studied civil violence, coercion, or even force. Their location of civil violence beyond what is generally considered political is said to derive from the absence of public issues and violent behavior. This section jumped out at me when I first read it back in 2015, because what it essentially says is that political scientists had always viewed violence as something outside of the political process. And knowing the history of this country, to make such an assumption is to be not only irrational, but to be ignorant to a very, very dangerous degree. Violence in this country, particularly violence between white people and violence between white people directed towards black people, is as political as anything. Thus, to hear that this man possibly walked into this church using counterviolence to murder one person in retaliation for what happened at Charleston a couple of years ago is almost antithetical to violence in the political sense, at least in the white mind. The fact that this hasn't received more attention maybe is a good thing. Maybe it's a good thing because, as many of you probably can attest, white people are already on edge because of the national anthem protests. They are on edge because of black men in general. And
on edge sounds like it might be a metaphor. Can you be more explicit without using a metaphor? What do you mean white people are quote unquote on edge?
Absolutely. And thank you for that. I completely looked over that. They are aggressively focusing on the situation that black people are creating by protesting these national anthems and in many instances seem to be strategizing ways to stop that situation from progressing, even if that brings about violence. So I believe that will, yes, that definitely does describe what I was trying to say. And ultimately, we as Black people need to be prepared for such instances where violence from them may be directed at us. And I'm afraid to say it, that might be coming sooner rather than later. Thank you very much, Gus. Thank you for the introduction. Your insights were very, very revealing. I'm actually going to go back and take some notes on them. Great job. Peace to you again.
Appreciate that. Thank you. I did just want to say with the quote-unquote anthem protests, there's, I think, a significant amount of evidence when Black people have done this sort of thing before with regards to not standing for the anthem or not participating in it sufficiently. Whites have shown the ability to stop that pretty quickly if they, you know, want to. That's my understanding based on history, that if whites really wanted to stop this, it would be stopped one way or the other. So I conclude that white people don't really have that much of a problem, at least the most powerful white people. They don't really have a problem with this at this point. Folks that we have not heard from at all, proceed. If you have a hand up, folks we have not heard from at all.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. Yeah, I had just actually found out about the situation with Cam Newton. And right at the same time, I did hear about the revealed racist tweets, I guess, from the white woman. And I think from what I had read, it was something about racist jokes, actually. And she said her dad was the best. Racist jokes all the way home. Was, you know, I guess they were traveling somewhere. I guess that was the context. And, you know, she was embracing her racist father, apparently, for telling racist jokes. So, you know, I'm glad as well that they were able to discover that. And it didn't seem like the people who were making commentary on what Cam Newton had said about females, I guess, speaking on running routes on football plays, but it didn't have that same eagerness, all right, about talking about racism. And I think that was, I guess, a clip from the Young Turks. And, you know, when the issues of race come up, it seems to be such, you know, a reserved tone, or people are like, well, you know, they're using words like alleged, and we don't want to have any certainty as to what happened. But a Black male says something or makes a statement of some sort, it's just going to conclusions immediately. Another thing I wanted to mention was there was this article that I read, and I wanted to send you this video, Gus. There's a high school over in Louisiana. I think it's called Rose Pine, like R-O-S-E-P-I-N-E, high school. And there's this interview, I believe it's a Black female. It's being interviewed, I think, by a Black male about an experience they had. I think it was Friday, September 29th. And there was a student who was called a nigger for, I guess he was kneeling, I guess, during the anthem. So she was saying apparently that the referee was, I guess, attempting to take back touchdowns that were scored by the team this player was playing on. And he was saying he went to report to his coach that he was called the nigger. So this black female, she was saying that, I guess when they were leaving, she said the police, the students, and the parents, and presumably she has to be talking about people who were classified as white, were calling them niggers and saying that they are trashy people. And when they got into their vehicles, they started surrounding their cars. So, you know, another really terroristic experience, I guess, you know, when it's centered around responding or countering racism. And I guess they didn't think that they would have that kind of a hostile and hostile experience with these individuals. So I'm still more into it, but there's a video interview that I was listening to that I'd like to see what your take on that would be. And that's all I have for now. Thank you.
Wow. Sounds like further evidence for me of black people divesting from sports. I think Dr. Anish, she was on the program a few weeks back, and unless we're talking about some stretching activities, something that's not any sort of organized high school athletics or AAU or anything like that, no way. It's no need to even invest our bodies in taking all of that stress and strain and punishment for the amusement of whites. But yeah, that probably going to be more that sort of flagrant white aggression. So and having, I think, talks with your offspring about what to do if you're in a situation and you don't feel safe, or, you know, you can establish a code in terms of what you all are supposed to do. If we're out someplace, we're immediately going to get to the vehicle, or what to do if there's a problem getting to the vehicle. Like, sounds like it might be important to have those sort of discussions and to do some trial runs so that that way you'll know what to do if you find yourself suddenly in one of these predicaments. Did we miss anyone? Anyone have a hand up that we've not heard from? We nabbed everybody who had a hand up. We didn't miss anybody. Grand. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you have commentary. Did anybody see any of the reporting that followed the alleged gunman in Vegas, Stephen Paddock, his the tragic arrangement, his so-called girlfriend or whatever, Mary Lou Danley? She, to me, looks like she would be classified as non-white. Did anybody follow the commentary around her? Seems like they were grilling financial transactions that she might have gotten money from the gunman before this took place. And if she knew about it, how did she allow, or how did he amass so many weapons without her knowing, or did she have any foreknowledge of his plans? Did anybody see any of the reporting around that tragic arrangement?
Can I be heard?
Let's get the female caller first.
Well, I'll try to be quick. This is Red again. Actually, I did notice that first off, and I definitely want to thank, you know, just my learning and everything that I learned from the Cows just by focusing on that, because actually my mother caught me about it, because my mother lives in Las Vegas. So, and she had also told me about, she had said that people had told her that there were bombs going off in multiple hotels. So that was also another, you know, false story. But I it seemed like they would not say that he was a white man, but they kept on talking about how this was an Asian woman. This was an Asian woman. We're looking for an Asian woman. And I even went online, not just watching the news, because I was woken up at 2 o'clock in the morning to hear about this. But when it, you know, after it happened, and my mother, she had worked that type of event last year. But the main thing that I noticed was that, you know, they would not give out really any information about him, but they were very quick to put her picture up. And I also noticed how, like, with all the different stations, no matter what station I turned on, they would show her face for, you know, very long, you know, 10 seconds, 15 seconds, what have you. And they would never classify. It took them hours to classify him as white. And also just to, you know, just even saying where he lived, and it's pronounced Mesquite, Las Vegas. I'm sorry, Mesquite, Nevada, which is north of Las Vegas. It's basically, you know, only casinos. It's not really much out there. That's all I wanted to add for now. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Mr. Steele, did you have commentary?
I definitely noticed the tragic arrangement that the alleged shooter was in. And I also noted that news agencies initially blanked out. Well, the original Facebook photo of Paddock was released, and it was uncensored. It showed his alleged sex partner right there in the photo. And then news agencies went ahead and started disseminating the photo with her edited out for a day or so. And then the uncensored photo became the one that news agencies used. And then they eventually started cropping her out and just focusing on the alleged shooter's face. The last news story that I heard regarding this victim of racism and this tragic arrangement was a news report that said she received a wire transfer of $100,000. Now, this was reported by multiple what they call mainstream news outlets, so I'm not sure if this is, you know, just more of the morass of confusion that's surrounding this story. Another thing that I wanted to let you guys know is that reports are indicating that Charlottesville is, again, the home of a torch-lit white supremacist nighttime march. The people who have been identified as the alt-right or whatever, the racists that are in that movement, have gathered back in Charleston. They have Charlottesville. They have a permit, as they are making it very clear that they have a permit to display this, this racist parade. And it's significantly less numbers this time. The reports indicate that it was around three dozen. That's still quite a bit of open white supremacists carrying torches and demonstrating at night. So, yes, the week that started with the tragedy that took place, or I guess the shooting that took place in Las Vegas, ended with black people being declared, or black identity extremists being declared the new terrorist threat, and the racist white supremacists staging yet another demonstration in Charlottesville in defiance of everything that has happened in the time since the last demonstration. So, I'm still disgusted. I'll mute my line. Thank you so much.
Indeed. I also thought it was significant the O.J. Simpson was released the same day as this alleged shooting happened, both in the state of Nevada. The day began with his release and the day ended with the shooting. Just interesting. Did other folks have commentary they wanted to get in? We have less than 30 minutes on the broadcast. Any other commentary folks wanted to get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to make an observation, but get your opinion on why is we all know why, but I just wanted to make sure that we recognize that the national media never classified this person as a terrorist. Why are they so, like, not using the T word?
I think that's the system of white supremacy. I think that's pretty consistent. When you have these sort of shootings, you can just pick out whichever one they do not. I don't remember them When it was Adam Lanza at Sandy Hook, I don't remember them calling him a terrorist either. I think the shooting that was in Colorado at the movie theater, James Holmes, I don't remember them calling him a terrorist either. It's consistent. They don't call Christopher Columbus a terrorist. You can just go right on down the line. Mary Kay Letourneau, she raped that non-white child out here. It's just consistent. Whites are never identified as terrorists. That is a term that is reserved for non-white people, especially black identity extremists now. Did that answer, or I guess other people can answer your question as we proceed, but did you have anything else you were going to add, sir?
No, I mean, that's my sentiment. That's exactly how I feel about it. That was very logical. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I was going to say something similar. Whenever, white people do things, it's just expected. So for them, it's normal behavior. And I think because they've normalized the violence that white people are capable of, they don't report it as terrorism. But if it's a non-white person, they have to utilize that approach in order to continue to make us the object of attack, in my opinion. So I agree with everything you said. In reference to the Vegas shooting, when I talked about multiple shooters, I wasn't talking about multiple shooters at the event. I'm talking about multiple shootings that took place the same night. And it was a lady took footage of the Bellagio and the Flamingo. And there was a driver out there, a Vegas driver, who had reported he had talked to the bellman there, and then both hotels were on lockdown the same night, and there was glass everywhere, and they weren't letting people out of the hotel. And she had posted footage of it to her Facebook page. There was a couple of bits of footage, but what it was that there were other people shooting the same night. I don't know about multiple shooters there. I'm just saying that multiple shots were fired in multiple locations on that night and around the same time. So that's what I found. And it was, I'll send you the article so you can see it for yourself. And there was something I wanted to touch on. You had, I think earlier this summer, you had had, I think it was a compensatory call-in where you were discussing Sweeney Todd. And it was a clip, I think, of Broadway, a Broadway production of Sweeney Todd. And I'd heard of the movie, never watched it. But when I saw it, when I listened to that program, you piqued my interest in it. So I recently actually saw it. And this was the movie that was done by Johnny Depp. He plays a star. He stars in it. And this is in like 2003. And as I was watching it, it just made me think, because the entire movie is about cannibalism, because they're putting humans inside of meat pies and feeding them to people. Pedophilia, because the judge actually falsely imprisons Johnny Depp's character and tries to take his wife from him when his wife does not give herself to him while he's in jail for 15 years erroneously. He ends up killing her by poisoning her with arsenic, and he kidnaps their child, raises their child, and then attempts to try and marry their child after he raises her. So that's the whole premise of the story. And I had no idea. I'm like, oh my goodness. And then he just kept getting away with murder, which kind of reminded me of the of Jack the Ripper. I've been watching the documentary on that, and they were talking about the fact that he was America's first serial killer who traveled to Britain and functioned as Jack the Ripper in Britain and then came back to the States. And one of his descendants is actually tracking his ancestors' movements to prove that Jack the Ripper is the same guy, H.H. Holmes, who was America's first serial killer. And so far, everything is leading in that direction. And just what you were talking about, the fact that this guy is not called a terrorist, Mary Kay Letourneau is not called a pedophile, all of this stuff just ties into this is white culture. And when white people do it, it's normal white behavior. When any non-white people do it, it's them trying to fight the system in a way that in which they have to be violently put down. Thank you. And I'll mute my line.
And I posted the link. There's a report from the New Yorker that just talks about some of what they were hearing the night of the shooting. And they said they were listening to a police scanner, and it came over the police scanner that there was a shooter at the MGM, a shooter at the Bellagio. It came in that there were multiple shootings multiple shooters. That's what they heard on the police scanner the night of the shooting. Folks can check that out at the New Yorker if you are so inclined. And we are in a system of mass deception, so it can be difficult to get information. Just with that terrorist thing as well, I'm even reminded Dr. Martin Kevorkian was on the program, I think, a couple weeks back. We were talking about different grouping of films. And I think the first film we started with, The Place Beyond the Pines, the white character played by Ryan Gosling, he's a terrorist in the film, but Dr. Kevorkian may have been an act of white supremacy. He started in his description where he said he's a beach blonde guy, and, you know, he's in the certain, all these other things other than a terrorist. It is ubiquitous. I think that's one of the things that just happens all the time, minimizing the terrorism and violence that whites enact on a regular basis. And then you contrast that with, like, Cam Newton's situation, or the way that they'll talk, oh yeah, we had to tase that 7-year-old, you know, he was getting rowdy and, you know, scaring us. Other folks have commentary before we proceed?
Oh yeah, Gus, I was just going to touch on that. I was thinking you had asked earlier why there's been little reporting of the alleged black male that shot at the church in, I think it was Tennessee. And what I think is what happened is this guy who shot up the event in Vegas, I think this was all to take everyone's attention away from bigger events, like what's happening with Houston right now, what's happening with Puerto Rico, what's happening with Florida. I just think that it's meant to take our attention from the bigger events of what's happening and focus it on sympathizing with white people, because white lives are held at higher value than non-white lives. So even for black people. So what better way to get everyone's attention, not just in the country, but in the world, but to have this shooting take place? Everybody's focusing on that, giving all of their attention, sympathy, whatever else, all of that energy, that delectable Negro energy towards that event, while Donald Trump is doing a bunch of other things in a different direction, ratcheting things up with North Korea, that we have severed diplomatic ties with North Korea, which, you know, once that happens, the next stage is a shooting war. So at any point, they can start shooting. And all of this is taking place right when the shooting takes place. So I just think that that's a part of it. And seems to me like he might even be a Manchurian candidate. I would say a person under some sort of mind control or something like that. I didn't want to use a metaphor. I apologize. The reason why is because his family's come out and said that he's a quote unquote fun loving guy, very funny, into laughing and all of this stuff. And they try to normalize him. So if he was this person and his brother was quoted as saying that he never even knew his brother owned a gun. He wasn't the type to own a gun, but he's in a room allegedly with 19 guns shooting at people out of a window. So either something had triggered him, he was set off by some sort of mind control, and it was meant to create this event to pull the nation's attention towards the bigger issues that are taking place, in my opinion. I'll mute my line.
Do we have any folks that we missed completely?
Copy, heard?
Yes.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. I just wanted to point out that where this guy is from, it's about a couple of miles away from Clive and Bundy's ranch. And I don't know if that's, you know, important, but they did have a standoff with federal officers last year. And I'm on the train running late for work. So I'm going to mute my line because I think it's about to pull off.
Indeed.
Can I be heard?
White people in gun ownership just does not surprise me at all. Hold on a second, Mr. Steele. The other caller that spoke up, proceed.
I just wanted to give a quick report. I don't know if anybody heard about this. In Oklahoma City, there was a like 4-month-old baby that was sitting on the freeway, and they found this baby. The baby had $5,000 in it, and in the carrier with it. It was just in a little car seat with $5,000. So whoever found this baby. And it was very, 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 very scarcely reported. And the lady was never charged. The mother, they did track down the mother, but she was never pressed with any charges. They never released her name or her image. So me and my think tank kind of figured that this was definitely a white woman that had a non-white child. And I just was wondering if anybody heard about this story, because they did not report on this at all. It was like really like hush, hush. So she had to be a white woman that left this. She's probably a married woman. I don't know. I'm just, you know, speculating. But she probably had a non-white child. And because I don't know any sisters or black females that just going to give their baby on the side of the freeway and then put $5,000 in the envelope. Like, so I just wanted to know if anybody knew about this story. I'll need my line.
I had not heard of it until you brought it up. I do see it. It was reported. It got, I guess, a lot of attention in the Oklahoma area for folks who were there. But obviously, if you live outside of that state, it looks like they maybe didn't say too much about it. But I do see the images. Looks like a child, at least to me, it looks like a child that would definitely be classified as non-white. And they, on here, they say that they found the mother eventually, although they don't give any identifying information. They just say that she was hospitalized. They didn't say that she was charged with any sort of crime or was going to be under any sort of DHS, Department of Human Services investigation or anything. They said that the baby was remaining in DHS custody, so she doesn't have the child back in the house with her, I guess, at this point, at least at the time of this report. But, yeah, I had not heard anything about it. Had anybody on the line heard anything about this?
Can I be heard?
Hang on a second, Mr. Steele. I'm taking that as a no. No one on the line heard about this. Grand. Yeah,
I have heard.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Just quick. I heard something about it, but I don't. I also assume that it probably was a white female or a white woman. That's all. Thank you.
Okay. I will post the article and see if there's any updating. Yeah, if it's difficult for me to imagine a black female or any black parent, period, getting that sort of leniency. Like if you remember the situation that happened at the Ohio Zoo last year when the child fell in the, I guess, moat or whatever it was, and the gorilla was there. They shot the gorilla, and people were talking about criminally charging this parent just for having their child at the zoo where she didn't do anything wrong, and they were talking about charging her. So I cannot imagine that sort of leniency being afforded to a parent. I mean, this to me seems like, wow, we're talking about a clear, undisputed case of neglect, abuse, all of the above, and nothing like... Yeah, I don't know. Having worked at social services, I have seen where they tend to be very aggressive. It's very easy to take children from black parents, and that's something that they do on a regular basis, like taking your child. So, yeah, I'll hush there. Mr. Steele?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. You know, just touching back on the Las Vegas shooting incident, there were a number of videos that came from this incident, but the ones that really struck me as interesting and worth noting by fellow victims of racism is the videos that were involving a character on social media called Dan Blazerian, who is this kind of very extremely macho, rich guy who apparently has a whole bunch of guns and, you know, he hangs out with whores and he, you know, goes and shoots these guns for YouTube and takes a whole bunch of pictures that a lot of victims really like. A lot of victims seem to worship this guy. And an interesting thing about this video was that in this clip, in the first clip, he's talking about, oh, I should have got my gun. I wish I had my gun. Like an idiot, I left my gun at home. And my question is, like, what would a small arms gun on the grounds other than confuse people about where the shooting is coming from and then, you know, get yourself shot by first responders? So, you know, that whole gun grabbing thing was impulse that the suspected white supremacists have.
was on display in that video. And then there was a subsequent video where he was digging through a police car looking for firearms. That was something that was really curious to me. I haven't seen any sort of reports indicating that he's in trouble for doing that either. It's just that to me was really, really disturbing. And I'm also equally disturbed by how many victims of racism go on to worship characters like this Blazerian guy. He, along with, you know, the Mark Dices, the Alex Joneses, and a number of these internet white supremacist characters have convinced a number of us, victims of racism, that they are people that we should worship or admonish, or celebrate. And I just caution you, do not listen to these characters. Do not look at these people as examples of manliness.
30 seconds.
You know, yeah, when the bullets were actually flying, this Dan Blazerian guy was running around clueless and making trouble for everybody. And that is what I suspect most white supremacists are going to do in a scenario where there would be a confrontation in these armed confrontation in these cities by opposing groups. So, I'm still disgusted. I'm going to go ahead and mute my line. Thank you.
For sure. Folks, we have not heard from who dialed in more recently. Did you have commentary? Thought we had some folks who got a hand up more recently. Did we miss anybody? Anybody who dialed in more later in the show who wanted to get comments in? Maybe they...
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Give me a moment, Gus, because I just stepped into the house because I just got off work.
Right on. For folks, it's always helpful for Gus T. If you wait until you are in a spot where you know you can chat and are ready to roll and then put your hand up, that is always helpful. Thank you kindly. Much obliged. We will be starting our new book, as I said, Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, on Friday, Workplace Racism on Thursday. Pam should be headed back to the cows this month as well. Long overdue. I think we missed one of our dates because of my back issues, but moving forward, healthy and ready to roll. Princess, did you need more time? Are you ready to participate?
Okay. All right. Hi. I was going to comment on some of the stuff with the shooting in L.A. I would advise people.
Vegas.
Vegas. I knew that. Thank you. And I would say that I was not surprised as far as how the media latched on in trying to put it out there that these were victims in the sense of, you know, they have no, they're typical, like, victims, how we see them. But I think one of the biggest things that I've tried to make a point to a lot of people that I was speaking about this to was the fact that it just seems like the media, the way that they're portraying some of these victims, until like a few posts that I've seen where some of the people involved in the shooting, if you can go down their timelines on Facebook, you'll see a lot of stuff in reference to, you know, a lot of anti-Obama rhetoric, Confederate flags and stuff. So I would just advise a lot of non-white people or black people to the names. I think USA Today just recently put out a full list of, I guess they settled on, 58 people that have gotten killed. And to just go down, like pick some of the names, and if their Facebook pages are still available. You can go to their pages and just get a look at who these individuals are. And, you know, they're just everyday white people, and more than likely they're Trump supporters. So I really can't say that I feel sorry for them, because it's kind of like they put themselves in a situation anyway. So that's the only thing. I missed most of the show because, like I said, I was at work, so I don't know what you guys were talking about.
Gossiping and name calling. That's what we were doing. Good to hear from you, Princess. That is a task. If folks have any extra time, if you are so inclined, you can check out, because they have a victim listing now to grab some of these folks' feet. Same thing like with that reporter who, you know, with the Cam Newton thing, you can just go through and check out some of their commentary to see, you know, what they said. Might be all kinds of things that you can find in there, what they were saying while the election was going on, or what they've had to say about Black Lives Matter. Might be all kinds of good. And this was a country music concert, so I mean, hey, who knows what you might find. We have about 5 minutes. Any final comments folks wanted to get in last 5 minutes?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. In regards to labeling Paddock, Stephen Paddock, a terrorist, just note that Dylan Storm Roof, who can legally be classified as a terrorist, was not charged for a terrorist act. According to the legal definition, it's the use of violence or threats in pursuit of political aims. This guy had a manifesto where he said that he was trying to start a race war. So in that case, white people cannot be terrorists. That's all I have.
Any other comments folks want to make sure they get in?
I, for one, have been hearing more than I would like to white people as well as non-white people using the term white privilege over the past couple of weeks, to where it's becoming a rather popular term, as opposed to an act or acts of white supremacy or white power. I've been hearing that a lot over the past 2 weeks.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Fire.
We did have retired firefighter, the person who spoke up before, the male caller who asked if he could be heard. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I just wanted to, I wonder why we keep giving them power with that word, white supremacy. That gets to me more than white privilege, because they're not supreme to me. So I think we should stop giving them that power as well. No white supremacy. They're not supreme, but that's all. I'll mute my mind.
Well, I've already come to a conclusion that they are, in terms of power on the planet, in terms of power between people. They are in the supreme position. I've made a conclusion about that. People who have a different opinion, obviously you don't have to use the term. The female caller who asked, it is retired firefighter who spoke previously. Did you have any other comments that you were going to get in?
No, I was just glad to hear him, that he made it through the hurricane, because I didn't know whether or not he was okay. So good to hear him.
Alive and well, considering that we're in a global system of racism and white supremacy. You know, but I'm the same. Thank you.
Final comments, folks satisfied?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to give an update that someone mentioned Richard Spencer. He is officially coming here to University of Florida on the 19th. And people have already started to, I guess,
get the police department to provide all kinds of security for them. But they said the price was, this has been going around in the articles, has been $500,000. So I guess they said that he's not going to pay for that, but I don't know if the university or the police department. So, you know, and they have these counter-protest people wanting to get people to go, want people to go to the campus to, I guess, do protests. And then it's the police department or the people at the police department saying that people shouldn't go out there. So I know that that would be a dangerous environment. So I don't know if I would, well, I wouldn't recommend people go out there to that kind of scene. So I don't know how that's going to look here. I've never really seen that happen. So, yeah, I just want to report that because it was pushed back because of the hurricane. So they said that he was going to eventually come to speak after they said that they rejected him. So I think the president at the university was practicing major racism and deception, because I think he already had accepted his offer before, but he just made it seem like he didn't. So just the usual going on with white conduct. And that's what I wanted to report. Thank you.
May I say something? I'm sorry.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Just real quick, this is Red from Ohio. It was me who mentioned Richard Spencer, and I'll make sure I give you all an update about if he does actually come to either the Ohio State University or the University of Cincinnati. And I know that there was I think there might have been a segment played some time ago where they do have certain universities, they do have policies where you have to be like a current student in order to have a room rented or like a auditorium rented or what have you. So I feel like whites, they are practicing racism because they have the ability to either raise the rent for people who they don't want there, or they can actually, or they have rules to say that, well, you can't just anybody from another student from a different state can't request to rent a room or have somebody speak at a different university. Thank you.
And we will wrap there. Thanks for all of the folks participating. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. We'll be back multiple times for the coming week. You can check the Facebook events page. You can check Black Talk Radio Network for all of the upcoming broadcasts. You can always feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. If you have questions, if you have trouble finding something in the archives, or if you have a guest suggestion or a general gripe about the broadcast, untiljustice@gmail.com. Right on. With that, I will again encourage sobriety would be best, especially with these, you know, different incidents that are happening where just randomly whites are threatening violence against black children, just anybody who's out and about. It would definitely be better to be sober so that you can make a quality decision to keep yourself safe in this environment saturated with white terrorism, white violence. They frequently, lots of evidence that they take advantage of us in a big way. When we're under the influence, not able to make quality decisions, get behind the wheel or what have you, they really take advantage of us. So I think Dr. Welsing and a lot of the folks that we esteem, they would strongly encourage sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy, especially if you are going to be in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Sobriety would be best, and buckle up. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice. immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in. And to founder of Black Talk Radio Network, Mr. Scotty Reed, hope he is taking excellent care of himself, rejuvenating, and ready to get back on his counter-racist grind as well. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.